I'm a serious man, Larry, and this is a serious podcast where Jake Regal joins Jackie and I to discuss the film A Serious Man. Leave it out for 10 minutes, letting it breathe. So important. JFIO presents.
What? Are you kidding? We got some family here.
This ain't no cooner.
Okay, I'm not gonna sit here and debate.
I'll show you the life of a man!
You will find a fortune. Good would not be the fortune you seek.
I suppose you think you raised hell.
When I've raised hell, you'll know it.
Something is very wrong. I don't want Santana Abraxas. I've just been in a terrible auto accident.
What's the most you ever lost in the coin toss?
Sometimes knowledge is useless. Accept the Mystery, a Coen Brothers podcast.
Welcome back to Accept the Mystery. It's the Coen Brothers podcast, where we discuss every single Coen Brothers movie in insane, utter, absolute, excruciating, and frightening levels of detail, frankly. My name is Josh Richmond. Sitting across from me is my co-host, the lovely, talented, intelligent Jackie Lechtoltze. I feel like I have to say all three of those adjectives every time now.
After your dad pointed it out.
Now I'm like, I'm not praising you enough.
I'm not flattered enough.
I'll make sure we'll have, should I just have like a flatter Jackie segment?
Mm-hmm.
5 seconds of like, just listing off all
Great. That will really help boost my self-confidence.
How is your Thanksgiving going?
It's great. It's, I guess it's still going. It's Thanksgiving weekend.
It's true. We're in the middle. We're in the midst of Thanksgiving weekend.
Mm-hmm. It's been good.
I saw you last night. We drank some Bolivian liqueur and played '90s R&B hits.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah.
I'm now a Singani convert.
That's right. Singani is the best. We should talk about that more.
We should.
I mean, like investing in it or something.
I'm seriously like, I want to like just donate $5,000 and get some shares and be and get rich off Singani. It's gonna be a hit.
In Soderbergh thing? Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I want to compete with Soderbergh. Maybe.
Yeah, of course you want to compete with Soderbergh, you're an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll get into that later on our business podcast.
That's right.
Where we discuss our business ventures. This is our movie podcast. So we got to introduce our guest on today's show. We have with us an actor and comic. He performs on the UCB team Cardinal Redbird. He also went to the same college as me, which means he's a goddamn hippie.
Ooh.
So, Jake Regal, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Welcome.
Sorry about the flies circling my dirty, dirty body.
It's all right.
Josh likes it. He's used to it.
No, exactly. None of us bathe here.
No.
You're lucky that podcast is just one sense and you can't smell it. Because if you could smell this podcast, you would want to stay away.
I did think about what shirt I was wearing in case you were taking pictures. Like, I didn't want to wear just the laziest, because I'm not doing anything else today.
Right.
Everyone's still out of town. Nothing's happening.
Right.
So I'm just going to laze around after this. And I'm like, I could wear just garbage.
Oh, no, same. This is.
I appreciate the thought you put into it.
Yeah.
This is absolutely the only thing I'm doing today. But I was like, okay, got to get ready for this and knock this out. And then I'm just going to fart around for like 12 hours.
Sounds
it's
good.
Gonna be awesome.
My Although place- we really should take more photos now that you say that. Mm. We don't take
do
enough think, photos of our guests. Yeah.
I'm to have more like social media presence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not listen, guys, it's not my best shirt.
No, but
it's just a shirt.
It's look, the thought that counts and you put thought into it. And
don't sell
that.
Yourself short. It's a great shirt.
It's a t-shirt, first of all.
Yeah, great t-shirt. it's like a sea green with like a with like kind of a Adobe red. Drawing of red. Mystical creatures.
It's actually a band t-shirt for the band Unknown Mortal Orchestra.
I know that band.
Do you?
I do. Funny Friends. It's a good song. Yeah.
It is a good song. I saw them live. They're very good.
They're really good. They're like Swedish, I want to say, or some sort of Scandinavian.
I think they're Australian. Maybe not.
They might be Australian.
Yeah.
I don't know. Whatever.
Same thing.
They're not American.
Right.
Which means it's cooler than I meant to them because I had to seek them out. That's the important thing. Anyways, look, we got to get into this movie. We got a big movie to talk about today. But
so
even
exciting.
before we get into the movie, we have to ask our guest questions loosely inspired by the movie in a segment called Inside Jake Regal.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
Oh no!
So Jake.
Yes.
The characters in the film A Serious Man are predominantly Jewish.
That's right.
I'm not even sure. Are you Jewish?
I am Jewish.
You are Jewish.
I'm ethnically Jewish. I'm very much agnostic, but I'm born Jewish.
Yeah, as much as we're all Jewish here.
Yes,
and
we are.
As much as my personal beliefs don't necessarily line up with exactly what's in the Bible, I definitely feel strongly Jewish as part of my identity. I went to a Jewish private school, which definitely informs a lot of how I saw this movie.
Sure, yeah. I was bar mitzvahed, so I got that part of it. It was a Reform temple, so it wasn't the Jewiest upbringing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not Reform temple too, but still bar mitzvahs.
But yeah, you went to day school though, so
yeah, sure, day school is legit.
Yeah,
I did go to a Christian summer camp, which was interesting.
I've done that too. Yeah. Interestingly.
What was that like? Did you guys have to like have do like pray to Jesus and stuff?
It wasn't that because it was YMCA, so it was Christian, oh, but not hit you over the head Christian.
Okay,
but we did have a campfire. It was on Catalina Island. It was actually very cool.
Nice.
And it was generally fine, except for the campfire songs, which were all praising Jesus, and so I sort of just mouthed along to them without actually.
I'm
singing.
Not saying this.
Yeah, exactly. I don't believe this. You can't make me.
There's some religious songs that kind of work equally well for both Christian and Jewish camps.
Not these songs.
Like, I forget what's the one, like, God said to Noah, there's going to be a floody, floody. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
I know that.
Yeah.
We had to sing that one at Jewish day camp. Yeah, and I figure they probably have that at Christian day camp, too, because it's Old Testament. It's still part of their thing.
Yeah, I don't know.
This is apropos of nothing, but I have to talk about it real quickly.
Please.
At this Jewish summer camp, one of the counselors had a character named Poopy, which was a sock puppet, but it's literally just a white sock with drawn-on eyes that copied Triumph the Insult Comic Dog's catchphrase, "For me to poop on!"
Right.
But copied nothing else about the character.
Oh,
like,
God.
All he did was say that, and I thought it was the funniest thing ever. And at the time, I was probably like 11 years old.
Right, so you don't know who Triumph the Insult Comic Dog is.
Yeah. And then I see Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and I see Triumph, and I legitimately thought, they stole Poopy.
They ripped off Poopy.
Oh.
Wait,
so sweet.
So wait, so was it like inspiring religious messages and then saying like, you know, being a bad kid is for me to poop on?
I wish it was for me to poop on.
Aw, that's cute. Anyway, my question was just, did you have a bar mitzvah and what was your bar mitzvah experience like?
I did have a bar mitzvah. It was not the coolest bar mitzvah, because here's what happened. You have to schedule your bar mitzvah pretty early in advance, because
They
have a calendar. And I scheduled mine, and then after that, I was a freshman in high school. My high school announced that the winter formal was on the same date. So, it was a pretty big conflict of interest.
No, because
you're right. You always have to, it's like a wedding. You always have to schedule the bar mitzvah way in advance.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I ended up, you know, my core friends were there. But it was not a huge turnout. But that's okay. I paid for a lot of my college. I got some cool stuff out of it. It was a good time.
Oh, yeah.
But you had like a daytime ceremony, obviously.
Yeah, we
like
did the whole thing.
But then your party was at night at the same time.
The party was at night. The DJ incorrectly said that my favorite artist was Kid Rock. It was very embarrassing.
Oh no.
Jake, it's time to play your favorite band.
Here's why. I was familiar with Kid Rock, as were most people. You can figure out how old I am based off this. I'll be 28 in a couple days, actually.
Happy birthday. We're all around the same age.
Yep.
There you go.
I remember Kid Rock well.
We did go to college together, so that follows. But, so there was one song by Kid Rock called Welcome to the Party. So I told the DJ, hey, it'd be funny or fun if you played Welcome to the Party at the beginning of the party. And he took that to mean Jake loves this guy.
Oh my God, it's so weird.
Yeah.
DJs don't have to do that. Like, it's not in their job description to announce.
Editorialize?
Yeah, exactly. Like, who asked you what my favorite band was?
Yeah,
like,
right.
It's not your job at all. You're not the MC or something.
And it would have been Blink-182 at the time.
Yeah, so there.
Or God forbid if they were like, here you go, Jake, Britney Spears, you love it.
Yeah.
I was an obnoxious kid even at 13, and I had a list of songs I wanted my DJ to play that were not, like, radio hits. They were just, like, annoying, like, indie hipster shit.
That's what I listened to now, but not when I was 13.
Josh was very cool.
I was already starting to get into it then. And it wasn't even that hipster. It was, but like,
what was the first band
you guys to play, like,
that got
Cake.
You into indie music?
As I was just saying, it actually might have been that. Because I remember hearing them on the radio and being like, this guy is cool, and going back and listening to some of their older indie albums. And then I saw like a tour bill they were on of the Flaming Lips, so I started listening to them. And the Flaming Lips, they're a good gateway into indie.
Yeah, for me, I listened to Weezer like everyone in high school.
Right.
But then someone told me that Weezer stole their sound from Pavement, which is not true at all.
No. Huh.
But it was still enough to get me into Pavement, which remains my favorite band all these many years later.
Pavement is great. No, Weezer and Pavement are not remotely similar.
No, they are not.
But I actually, a lot of my musical connections are you read a certain review of a band who says, this song sounds even a little bit like this band. And you're like, I got to go check it out.
Yeah.
And then you're like, this guy was totally wrong, but I love both bands. So.
Mm-hmm. Like written Pandora. Like if you like this, you might like this.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Pandora with words before Pandora was a thing.
I'm still on Last FM, guys.
Ooh.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. I did not even know that was still existing.
Oh, it's still around. I like it that it compiles what I'm listening to. Why does no one else think that's interesting?
I mean, I can see what other people are listening to on Spotify, and I almost never think it's interesting.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah.
But it's more really for personal use. I'm like, what did I listen to the most in the last 3 months? That's interesting.
That's true. Yeah. I could go to my iTunes and look at the most played songs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mine's probably embarrassing.
It is. What... You know what? I have my iTunes open right now. I'm going to find out.
Yeah, tell us.
What is my most played song?
Although mine...
My most played for the last year has to be Parquet Courts, because they put out 2 albums this year, and they're both great.
I like Content Nausea.
Yeah.
It's pretty solid.
My top listen to has to be Buena Vista Social Club, because I've written...
Really?
Well, because I've written every single paper, every single brief. I'm a lawyer for background, too. So, like, since law school, maybe even since college, I've been writing, like, all my papers, because I don't speak Spanish, so it doesn't disturb me, and I don't try to sing along. And the music is just so perfectly, like, rhythmic that I don't get disturbed by it. So I listened to 2 of their albums on repeat forever on loop. And so my top played songs, I think I looked at it once.
You're torturing yourself.
No, it's great. Okay. I really like it. Yeah. I love Cuban music, but...
It's the same Cuban album over and over
It's again. 2 albums, okay. So at least it's 2, and it's not the same hour.
So that's a good hour and a half of music.
Yeah, maybe up to 2 hours. Yeah, an hour and a half to 2 hours. So I have that on loop, and I don't even hear the difference. Like, sometimes I'll accidentally have the same song playing over and over, and I don't realize. And I'm like, oh, this is the same song going.
It's just oral wallpaper to you. It's just like something, so it's not silent.
Yeah, but it also, like, makes me, like, more relaxed, and my juice is flowing, and I always write better. Like, when I try to, because I feel like I've listened to him so many times, I'm like, I can't do this again. And then when I try to do it without it, I struggle. And then I'm like, I should just put it on, and then it's always better.
You at least need a new Cuban album. Okay, I'll get you into, like, some Afro-Cuban music.
I mean, it's borderline Afro-Cuban. I've tried other stuff. It's not, I don't know, there's something like, when it's just Social Club, it's like the perfect...
It just doesn't hit that spot in your brain. It doesn't give you that fix.
Right, this does. Yeah. It's so weird. So that's my top played. I'd have to look... What's under that?
Well, I've just looked, and apparently it's Fleet Foxes.
Oh.
I'm okay with that. Fleet Foxes are
a
good band.
Do they have something new this year, or are you just listening to a lot of...
Well, this isn't from the last year. This is all time.
Got it.
Yeah. Hopelessness Blues is apparently my most played album.
My number one all time would be Destroyer, because of college. I was intensely into Dan Behar and everything he put out.
I mean, that guy's a great lyricist, but it's hard for me to listen to him sing. He's got one of those really, like, super pinched voices.
Yeah, I haven't actually listened to... I didn't like his most recent album that everyone loved, Kaput.
Right. That was kind of a little bit more produced and had the sax.
The sax drove me insane in that album. It felt like a joke, but like an entire album-wide joke.
I like sax. I wish the sax would make a comeback.
Yeah.
There's something incredibly cheesy about it that actually...
There's a little bit of sax in pop music right now.
Well, the Ariana Grande thing. She kind of brought the sax back.
Mm-hmm. That Bruno Mars song that they played on SNL is like incredible. I don't even know what it's called.
Are you talking about the one with Mark Ronson?
Yeah, the funk song. That's crazy. I love that song.
It sounds completely from a different time period.
I know.
Like, it doesn't, because when I heard it on the radio, I was like, I thought it was like on the wrong, it was on Kiss. So I was like, are they playing the wrong thing?
Yeah.
Like, it just seemed like not even like a modern take.
Well, that's
funk.
All Bruno Mars does. He's a total throwback.
It was Mark Ronson, to be fair.
Mm. Yeah.
With Bruno Mars on it. So I feel like that's like a Mark Ronson, like, very specific type of production. But I was surprised that it was like so literal. Which is great. I think it was good, too.
Because he did that, like, that song that just sounds like a Michael Jackson B-side. Like, a lot of his songs just sound like complete throwbacks.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the answer to that question.
Long answer to that question.
He did have a bar mitzvah.
Oh, yeah, I had a bar mitzvah.
That was the question.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say something about my bar mitzvah, too, which was, it was a daytime party, so I didn't have to worry about anybody leaving for, like, cool nighttime activities.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, we did
have a bar mitzvah. Yeah. Wah.
Which means you're not really Jewish.
Yeah, okay.
And not really a woman.
That's true.
Yeah. You never became a woman.
Yeah, but wait, she gets to keep her Jewish identity. She's just a child, right?
Well, okay,
I guess that's fair. You're a little Jewish girl.
Look, little secret, all right? So actually, in Reform, it probably doesn't matter, but my mom's mom is not Jewish because my parents are so she's
so the bloodline died there.
So the bloodline, technically, I consider myself Jewish because I'm like 3/4 Jewish, but I'm not the right quarter.
Ooh.
Or I mean, like, that one quarter is the mother's.
It's
the mother's side, but it doesn't matter because in Reform they don't care anymore. So I'm Jewish. The end.
Yeah.
And what I actually am thinking about having an adult bar mitzvah with my friend.
My mom had an adult bar mitzvah.
Oh, cool.
It's a bar mitzvah when a girl does it.
Okay, but the reason I said bar mitzvah, thank you for correcting me. Think you're so smart. Is that I'm gonna probably do it with my friend who's a guy. So that would make it a bar mitzvah.
Like a dual thing?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Because, you know, sometimes, like, kids do that. They have it, like, they do it together with somebody.
When my mom did it, like, there were 10 people up there who were all doing it simultaneously.
Oh, see, there. And it would be called a bar mitzvah if there were men present. Boom.
I guess so. Because it's
Judaism. Patriarchy,
men,
baby.
Yeah, men always take dominance right. over women. So, Larry has a scary neighbor who likes to go hunting.
Yeah.
Have you ever gone hunting, or have you ever fired a gun?
I fired a gun. I went skeet shooting. I've never been hunting. I went skeet shooting with my family, I think, at, like, during my grandfather's funeral. It sounds like a bummer, but I think it's true. Or at the very least, like, one of the last times when my grandfather was very sick.
Maybe it's like a way to pay tribute to him if he was into skeet shooting.
Sure, there you go. He wasn't, but let's say that. But he had, like, we had, like, two real shotguns, and then one, I mean, it's a real shotgun, but it was, like, a 60-year-old, like, wooden piece of garbage shotgun. And my sister and my mom, of course, got to use the good, real shotguns, and I had to use this horrible one. And so they were doing so much better than me, and it was so emasculating, as I was never hitting any of the targets.
Aww.
But then, I finally, near the end, they're like, do you want to try this one? And I'm like, yeah. And I immediately started destroying these clay pigeons. Like, good, it was just the gun, me. I'm not a sad person, I'm not. I don't know if I would go hunting at this point in my life. Having not done it for the first 30 years, I don't know if I would start at this point.
It seems like a kind of thing your family gets you into at a young age.
Right.
It's like a father-son bonding activity, and keep it going with the future generations. It does seem like a weird thing to get into as an adult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not a vegetarian, so what am I? Yeah.
Yeah. No, I just, yeah.
I'm a major meat eater.
Me too.
Me too,
I'm a huge carnivore.
But I don't want to kill animals. I just want to think of them, you know, being, you know, humanely killed at, like, a factory.
Yeah, humanely.
Miles away
that's
from
the ticket.
Yep. I'm sure that's what's happening, and I don't want to hear any information to the contrary, so don't tell me.
Don't even let me tell you about how awful it is.
Have you seen Food Inc.?
No, I did see Fast Food Nation.
Yeah, I didn't see that one.
Yeah,
I didn't see Food Inc., but I know everything that's in Food Inc.
Right. There's only one really gross part, where they reach into the side of a cow to feed it. Like, there's just a hole in the neck of a cow, and they just put, like, fucking food in it.
I think I saw something like that. Like, it was like a... I don't think it was at a slaughterhouse. I think it was actually, like, at an educational farm for kids. But they had a cow with a hole in its side, and you could reach directly into its stomach and feel like the cow's juices.
Yeah, that's a real bummer.
Ugh, that's kind of cool. It's like...
No, it's not cool. Cows are supposed to eat grass and be happy, and then die when we eat them.
It's like in like an exploratorium
they die
for biology.
Before we eat them,
I mean, hopefully.
Well,
I have no stomach for that.
I am a sad person because I used to shoot BB guns, and when I went to camp in like third grade, fourth grade, and I hit the target maybe one out of four times. Mm.
But you were also pretty young,
yeah,
fourth grade.
But I don't think my sense of aim has improved since then.
Well,
I mean, I could
have
test
you tried.
It. I could test it. But I doubt it. Well, I also tried archery. I was worse at archery.
Archery's hard.
Archery's really hard.
Yeah,
when you see, like, fucking Legolas or whatever drawing back that bow and shooting arrow after arrow, you don't... That's a lot of arm strength.
You went with Legolas over Katniss. I think that's interesting in this day and age.
Well, I also went it over Ygritte.
What's that?
Ygritte.
Okay.
From Game of Thrones. I could have gone there if I wanted.
Well, I don't know what words you're saying, because I don't watch Game of Thrones.
Neither of us do. Please stop talking about Game of Thrones.
Thank you.
Now you know somebody is an archer. Ooh.
Yeah. Spoiler
alert. I just know Katniss because, hello.
But yeah, that's a lot of arm strain. Those bows
are thick.
Can we
talk about the third Hunger Games movie instead of A Serious Man?
I haven't seen it
because I haven't seen the second.
I actually
have only seen the first one.
Second one's great. Third one I have mixed feelings about.
Okay.
Just we should have nothing little... happens in it, but I guess you could have predicted that because they split one book into two movies.
We should have a mini podcast.
But better than
when
they split
The
Hobbit into three movies.
Yeah, it's insane.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Wait, can I also say I have shot a gun too, since you didn't ask me? I'm going to tell you about it. No,
wait. Jackie, have you shot a gun?
I'm answering my own question because I already started this conversation.
Uh-huh.
But I've got to ask the question first.
Fine.
You can't take control of this interview.
Yes,
live podcast.
Let's
ask it at the same time.
Yes.
Jackie, have you shot a gun?
Nice, guys. Very nice. Good group thing. I have shot a gun, but actually only once, which is weird because my dad has so many guns and loves guns, but he never took me shooting. Who knows why? And then I went shooting with a friend like a few years ago, and it's actually kind of scary because the gun is so... Like, it was like, you know, a real gun at a range or whatever, and it's just like it was like a Glock or who knows what, and it just felt so scary and real because you're like, oh, this is a gun that like kills people, and it was kind of scary. I was pretty good at the target, but I don't know. I haven't done it since. I would like to, but it hasn't come up.
But it is. There is something I haven't shot like a real gun, but I do have to imagine there's something just about the power of holding something like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of scary.
Scary.
Like, have you ever had just like... Like, have you ever been on a bus and thought, like, I could just, like, sock the guy standing next to me in the face?
Yeah.
You'd never actually do it, but you thought, like, what if I did it? What would happen?
I haven't thought of that exact thing, but definitely right. similar that things where it's, like... Thing.
I feel like, yeah, if you were holding a gun, that urge would be, like, 10 times as much. Like, what if I just, like, shot someone?
Ooh, we're getting into politics here, bro.
Yeah. We're having another round table this
I
time
did
around.
See on CNN, the top story yesterday was that Black Friday gun sales were the highest they've ever been this year.
Oh, well, yeah. Sign of the times.
Yeah. Man.
Well, I will say that I think... And without getting too political, I don't think it's political, but I think that if you know how to use a gun and you use it like more frequently, then you won't have that weird thing with it where you're like, whoa, this is weird and scary. Because for me, I've shot a gun once, so my only experience with it is like, whoa, it's like a gun.
Right.
Whereas like if you know what a gun is, you know how to use it, you've been trained, unlike What's-His-Face, George Clooney's character who's like a fucking idiot. Right. But like when you use your gun, I feel like you're not as liable to like do something weird and like... When,
yeah, but that's not that's based the, off your familiarity with the gun, but your own stupid emotions. That's where shit goes
haywire. Right. But I think like when your habits with it are better. I mean, yeah, if you're crazy, like please don't have a gun. But
that's definitely
like,
the argument.
Josh is crazy.
Okay, now I am going to get into this because it's not about just crazy people, but people have momentary lapses of sanity. Everyone
yeah,
does.
Yeah, that's right. True.
And if you have a gun by your side... Shit can happen.
You're right. I hear a really similar argument from like people who are for responsible gun ownership a lot, who say like if you're trained to use a gun, then you're going to be a lot less likely to fire it in a heated situation.
I think that's partially true, though. I mean, if you have like a real heat of the moment, yes, that's probably a problem. But I think that when you're trained, that means like your instincts and habits are trained too. But of course, that doesn't account for like a serious momentary lack. You know, lapse in judgment or emotional, like, you know.
Yeah, if you're like a gun owner, if you're trained to use a gun, you're more likely to just think about using a gun in certain situations. Something that might turn into like a bar fist fight gets escalated because you decide to pull up your shirt and show people you have a gun there.
And your pecs. You want to show
your
pecs.
And your pecs, yeah.
Yeah, I think it depends. I feel like there's so many different type of gun owners.
Sure.
It's hard to...
Of course there
are. There will be
I'm
the guy who will
I'm not indicting anyone
shirt.
Who owns a gun.
No,
in
no,
fact,
no,
I think weapons are hella cool. But, but, yeah.
That took an interesting turn.
No, I do. Like, if I might start collecting knives. I think knives are very cool.
Whoa.
But...
Yeah, my brother played around with knives for a little while. The whole, like, flipping them around. And
yeah.
Like, oh.
Yeah. Or playing, like, the game where you're, like, you know...
I would never play that.
That's a horrible. That's not a game. That's like a bad gamble. I don't like. Which also reminds me of Blood Simple when she stabbed him in the hand.
Mm. Yeah,
I haven't seen Blood Simple.
Ooh, you should see it. I love it.
I've seen 11 Coen Brothers movies, which
that's
is good,
good.
But that also means that there's several I have not seen.
You have seen most. Which other ones have you not seen?
I have not seen Miller's Crossing. I have not seen.
We liked that one. I think didn't love it, but we liked.
I haven't seen Inside Llewellyn Davis.
Oh. Well, we haven't gotten to that one yet,
right.
So Jackie hasn't seen it either.
Who knows?
But yeah, catch up with that.
Oh,
one.
Is
that's
the premise that you have not seen any of these movies?
Yeah, except then it turns out I did see Burn After Reading and completely forgot because I hated it.
Right, blocked it out of your memory.
Yeah, but I also forget movies all the time.
But for the most part, you have not seen any of these.
I think that's the only one I've seen.
You would not
I'm
see-
sure because I never saw like The Big Lebowski. I never saw like
Fargo?
No Country for I never saw Fargo. I never saw No Country for Old Men. Like there's a bunch that I had not seen, but for some reason, Burn After Reading, I did see because somebody forced me to watch it so that I could see how good Brad Pitt was in it. Because I didn't love Brad Pitt, and then I was like, fine, Brad Pitt's good.
Right, he's good in this one movie at least, and in a bunch of other movies.
Another
I think you're
weird movie
like
that he's good in is Snatch. Which is definitely
I haven't seen,
a high school favorite. Like in high school, I was all about that movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen
like,
it.
Yeah, okay.
I've always meant to.
He is really good at that with the incomprehensible accent.
Yeah, it's very funny.
I didn't love Snatch overall, but I liked it.
No, I don't like it anymore. But I liked it at the time.
Yep.
I feel like he stars in many of those movies, Fight Club.
Yeah. Fight Club was a movie I loved in high school and still love. That one is
I saw
up.
Fight Club for the first time like a few years ago, and I definitely liked it.
Yeah.
I'll stand behind it too.
There's definitely humor in it. There's things that are interesting in it.
And there's definitely, I think I could see why it appeals to like high schoolers and college students, because there's for sure elements of like kind of a teenage boy fantasy in there.
Right.
But I think it holds up nonetheless as an adult.
I agree.
Anyways, let's get into the actual movie we all have assembled here to talk about.
But there's so many more anecdotes.
I know. We want to get to know each other more.
Yeah. I know. I wish we could get... We'll have to get to know each other after the show.
All
we'll
right.
have we'll
Fine.
Have some Thanksgiving bonding. In the meantime, let's dive into the movie of the week in a segment called The Big Reviewski. So, A Serious Man, released in 2009, starring Michael Stuhlbarg. This is There's a lot to get into with this movie. There's a lot going on in this movie. It's deep.
Yeah.
No movie since Barton Fink has had as much going on as like a thematic and symbolic level. I don't know. We should probably just start where the movie starts. We should start with that fable that opens up the film.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this. It's not based on any sort of true story or any sort of like pre-existing Yiddish folktale. It's something invented whole cloth by Joel and Ethan Coen.
I mean, Dybbuk's are real. Right?
Well, Dybbuk's are a real concept. Right. I don't think Dybbuk's are actually real.
Dybbuk's are real. Come on. Dybbuk's are real.
But they built, they built this story around the idea of a man who may or may not be a Dybbuk, and it's left very ambiguous at the end.
Except he's credited as Dybbuk in the credits.
But he's credited as Dybbuk?
Oh,
with a question mark. Yeah.
I think he was a Dybbuk.
You think so?
Yeah.
I mean, they definitely leave it deliberately ambiguous.
I know, but I think he was a Dybbuk.
What makes you think that?
I just think that the way that she was so sure made me believe it. And even though he was like bleeding and like walked out like that, it still seemed like his reaction was not like
right.
Human.
He was untouched, basically.
Well, no, he started bleeding.
No, I know, but he didn't react in any way.
Yeah, yeah, he just like left.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, he didn't seem like somebody who had actually been stabbed to me, so...
Yeah, that's kind of the way I was torn too, because on one side, Dybbuk's are obviously fantasy, and you would be inclined not to believe a guy's a Dybbuk. On the other hand, he just seemed like kind of a dummy, and she seemed so sure, like completely confident.
More importantly, I was thinking the whole time, oh, that's the guy from Boston Public.
Is that the guy from
Boston? Finkel.
Oh, yeah. Feverish Finkel, yeah. He was like a old, like... Borscht Belt Yiddish comedian.
Yeah.
He's been around the block for like a long time. He's a legend. Grew up like speaking Yiddish, so actually a guy who's like a native Yiddish speaker. Some critics have said that this little story kind of ties into the rest of the film on a plot level. I don't know. Like Roger Ebert said basically that everything that happened to Larry Gopnik was a curse that was brought on by this Dybbuk like a century ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's necessarily a direct threat to support that quote.
I didn't see
to
that.
To quote the IMDb trivia, I just rewatched the movie last night. The Coen brothers claim it has no connection to anything, but
they always
lie.
Do that.
They always say it's so annoying. They would say that no matter what.
Right.
At least in this case, I'm inclined to take them at their word. Ethan Coen said we basically invented this story to kind of set up the tone and the themes of the rest of the movie.
Right, and which means it does have a connection.
That's
a fallacy.
It has a thematic connection for sure.
So that's a connection.
I just don't think it means that like whatever happened to this possible Dybbuk and this family has any sort of actual influence.
Oh yeah, I don't think it's a plot connection necessarily.
Yeah, I had that same feeling too, that it just sets up the tone and the concept of a Dybbuk and
uncertainty is a thematic element.
So just setting up that uncertainty and ambiguity. It's all it's done in a very narrow aspect ratio, which kind of interestingly sets it apart from the rest of the film and makes it seem like a little older, or like you're looking through a window into the past almost.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird to see anyone under 50 speaking Yiddish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing too, is I actually asked Josh, because like I've heard very little Yiddish in my family, because my grandpa speaks a little bit, but mostly it's Russian anyway. And so I was like, Josh, like what language is this? Because it seemed like it would be Yiddish, but then for a second I thought it was like Swedish or something. I couldn't place it. And then I was like, oh, it is Yiddish. Because there weren't enough familiar words to me that I would know right away that it was Yiddish. That was really interesting. But yeah.
Right. It is though. I mean, just listening to it, it's one of those great... It's the reason so many comedians came out of that tradition. It's just one of those great funny sounding languages.
It is.
It has so many funny phrases, expressions and concepts and like humor just in like
inherent to the language.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but just like the way like you express it. Like Russian's kind of similar to that too, where there's just like so many different like phrases that you use for stuff or whatever, and you're just
Yiddish
like,
is basically a dialect of Russian. It's very
It's like born of Russian.
Isn't
it like Russian? Well, I think it's like German, Hebrew,
right?
Russian, but yeah.
There's a little bit of all those things,
but
I mean,
there's
it
like
was,
that humor to it that's like that, yeah.
Yeah, there's something very funny about it, and I think there's a reason that a lot of like that kind of style of Jewish storytelling and Jewish humor came out of Yiddish, and in many ways, kind of almost sounds best in Yiddish.
Mm.
So it's cool. It's cool to have that tie back to that old style of Jewish storytelling, which this arguably kind of falls in the tradition of. Because the main story is itself kind of a fable.
Right.
Yeah, to break into the main story itself.
Where do you begin?
I know.
I know, it's tough.
Well, there's... Unlike the first story, although technically nothing supernatural necessarily happens in the first story, there's nothing supernatural happening in the story itself. But it feels very weird, and it feels like there is higher forces at work somehow, and just this confluence of events that are happening to Larry. The fact that all these things are happening at the same time.
Right.
And the presentation of Cy Abelman when he appears is he's almost like a demon or like a Dybbuk. Yeah. Even after death, that he comes back and he keeps haunting Larry's dreams.
But a very friendly demonic presence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like a creepy, charming, friendly demonic presence. I hated him so much. I was just like, ugh, I know. You need to take a shower.
Yeah, when we were watching it, you were just like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Like a visceral reaction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he was just like so steamrolling him. It was just like, and poor guy. Ugh,
and he was destroying his life behind his back.
Yeah.
So that's very Dybbuk-like.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Not just stealing his wife, but also kicking him out of his house and
sending the letters.
And sending letters to the tenure committee trying to get him kicked out. Why?
But, I mean, the fact that they were both in a car crash at the same time was interesting.
Right.
I love how it was set up, too.
A lot of the movie is like, what is an act of God and what isn't?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one case of that. And, of course, the ending, another one.
Right.
Yeah.
Where it's because of the way it's cut and the way that certain events seem to happen exactly at the same time, it's implied that there is some kind of divine intervention happening here. But unlike a movie like Barton Fink, where there's elements of just pure surrealism, everything that happens here like could theoretically happen.
Right.
Yeah.
It's grounded in that kind of realism.
Yeah. Anything that doesn't ends up being a dream.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That was great. I was like, oh, because of course when he showed up in the costume, I'm like, see, he is a Dybbuk. And then I was like, oh, it was his dream.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. No, it's very well crafted to make you feel like that.
Yeah.
But nothing out of the ordinary ever actually really happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is true.
But yeah, man. Yeah, I do all the performances of this film were great, but yeah, I do want to spotlight, Fred Melamed as Cy Abelman and just that purring voice.
His giant hand.
Yes.
Oh,
It's funny, this movie's, I really like I really like Serious Man, but it's in a genre that I don't usually like. Like, movies about the suburbs where bad things happen to everyone drive me insane.
True.
Like, The Ice Storm and American Beauty. Like, I don't really like either of those movies.
But it's not... Yeah. You're right that it takes place in the suburbs, but it's a little different than those films.
Yeah.
Like, American Beauty is all about the suburbs aren't this perfect place that it appears that there's this rot underneath the surface.
Right.
Yeah.
That's basically that's what The Ice Storm is, too.
Right. This isn't necessarily about how the suburbs are an evil place.
No, you're
right. It's more about how one man who happens to live in the suburbs is kind of dealing with just all these problems.
But it's interesting that it's not... Yeah, I mean, considering how strongly the suburbs like appears in this film, I mean, you're always seeing suburbs, suburbs, suburbs. It has nothing really to do with the suburbs, which is interesting because you're right that like it seems like it would be a movie in the suburbs, but... It's not part of the theme, almost.
If anything, the suburbs seem almost idealized in certain ways, and just very kind of like gorgeously shot. A lot of the lighting, like at times, I was like, "Man, it must have been like cool to live in a place."
I was
like
"I want to
really
live
just
there."
Sweet and peaceful.
Honestly, I did not get that vibe.
I did, except for the weird music.
All the houses are so tiny and sad, and there's just like so much sky and just empty space.
It's, right,
but they had so much grass.
That's what I was thinking.
No
it's big. It's big sky country, and like tons of grass and it's kind of beautiful.
I think we idealize different things then.
Perhaps.
I like the city, baby.
I like the city too. I really like both though for different reasons.
Yeah.
I think that's why
it's
close to me too.
I mean, trust me, I've always been a city dweller. I think I would go crazy living in a really small town. But but there's something about seeing it and sometimes being like, man, it just looks peaceful and sweet. And and one of many times where I felt like, man, Larry just doesn't really appreciate how good in many ways he's got it.
Mm.
You thought that?
Well, okay.
Richard Kind's character thinks that.
Richard Kind's character definitely thinks that. There's a lot going on in this movie and a lot of ways to interpret it, which is part of why I love this film. And I've got a really specific take on what exactly is going on here.
Hmm.
I almost feel like in many ways this film is like the Coen Brothers' Mentaculous. Like, if you dissect it hard enough and try to figure out what's going on here, you could almost unlock what's their moral universe and their point of view on how they treat their characters in all their movies.
Mm-hmm.
I've thought a lot about this film, and I do have kind of a specific take on why all these things are happening to Larry, But before I say that, I'm curious to hear your thoughts, because I think it is kind of the central question.
And then
question
you'll tell here. Us what the right answer is.
I'm not saying it like that. I'll just say I don't want to influence you guys unduly.
Okay. Well, our thoughts on what?
I think the central question here, and correct me if you think there's a different central question, but basically, why are all these things happening to Larry? And did he deserve it, or is it just an example of there's no God in this world, or there's an unjust God who will just punish you for no reason?
Well,
I have my idea, so you go first.
You have yours?
Yeah, I have an idea.
I don't, so you go first.
But I want to know what your idea is without hearing
that's
my
what,
idea.
That was what I did.
Yeah, but that's fine, so, but now we're playing Jake in the hot seat.
Okay. Yeah, but I don't have a good theory.
Okay, then that's right, fine. No, pressure, no pressure.
Jackie,
no,
you got to kick things up.
No, that's fine. I have a very biased point of view because it has to do with my own life and kind of like watching a lot of the randomness in the other movies and sort of like having that weird nihilism creep up into my
randomness
life.
Is definitely an overall theme in Coen Brothers movies.
Yeah. And seeing that over and over and kind of like connecting that to my own life. And I especially had like recent stuff come up too, where I was just like, you know, sometimes things happen the way they are. And you, like, I'll ask like, what, like, why is this happening to me? Like, why? But there's no answer to the why. It's just like, it's happening, and you might never get the answer to that question. So then, to me, it feels
like...
That's
definitely reflected in the Second Rabbi story, I would say.
With the teeth. That's true. Teeth, although I thought that was a really annoying way of telling a story. I was like, shut up. This is the worst story. But you're right. That is his point, too.
I mean, I'm so with you there that he's got a... There's a reason he's telling the story, and he maybe makes a good point, but he just has this smug smile on his face the whole time.
It was so annoying. I was like, shut up.
Like, come on, you know what you're doing when you just stop the story midway through.
Yeah, like, yeah. He could have explained that same concept. But yeah, so I think, like, sometimes asking why doesn't matter anymore, so because you're not going to get the answer to why. So I feel like me personally in my life and, like, seeing these movies too, like, it's just sort of, like, an acceptance of, like, this is how things are, and they're happening, and you don't know why they're happening, and you could try to find meaning in them. And sometimes it helps to find me, like, oh, well, maybe... Like, in certain ways, yeah, maybe you deserved it, right? Like, maybe he wasn't paying attention before, so the lesson is now he needs to pay more attention to his life so that other things don't happen to him. Like, there's that part of it, too. But I think sometimes so many things happen that you can't say, like, I deserve this. Like, you're like, what? Am I an evil person? I don't deserve this. So you kind of have to, and this is not a good answer to anything, but for me personally, what I'm doing and what I see in these movies too is like you just have to accept the randomness of life and just sort of
accept the mystery.
You could say exactly. That you have to accept the mystery. Yeah.
Yes. Very weird connection and themes throughout.
Well, I don't think that's deliberate.
To my life. That's what I'm saying. Like, my life is accepting the mystery. Yeah.
Here's something I think is in the movie. I could be wrong, but it's clearly Schrodinger's cat as a principle is very important to this movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The movie is about, like, physics versus the spiritual or metaphysical or whatever. And you see it in a couple different ways. You see it literally as he's teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see it, the South Korean student, what's his name, Clive?
Clive.
Clive doesn't understand it mathematically, but he recreates it with the concept of the money being there and not being there at the same time.
It appears in a couple different ways.
I think the presence of God is the third and largest example of Schrodinger's cat in the movie. We are not sure if God is responsible for any of the repercussions that any of the characters are feeling. It seems that at once he's responsible for all of them and none of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, he might be the presence behind everything, or it might just be physics, or it might be some combination of both.
Right.
We don't know. That's really interesting, actually. I think Schrodinger's cat shows up in a few different ways.
Mm-hmm.
In one sense, the entire movie is set up as a Schrodinger, because the very first time you see Larry, he's being inspected by the doctor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the very last time you see Larry, he finally gets the message from the doctor about the state of his health. And we don't know exactly what the answer is, but it seems like it's bad.
Yeah.
But the entire story that takes place in between, Larry could be sick or he could be healthy. You don't know. Mm-hmm. You don't know until that call from the doctor comes in and everything kind of snaps into place. So in that sense, the entire movie, it's almost like a judgment on Larry, it seems like. Like, he's doing all these things, and he has some... he's dealing with all these different problems, and the way that he solves those problems is somehow going to affect whether or not that call that he eventually gets at the end of the movie is good or not.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because it's not the truth until it's observed as part of Schrodinger's cat, right?
Right.
Yeah.
The truth is there the entire time, but we don't know what the answer
but
is.
But the
right.
truth is that he's sick. Why does that have to do with him making good or bad decisions along the way?
We know that he's sick throughout the movie by the end, but throughout the entire time we're watching it, he could be sick, he could be healthy. We don't know until that box gets opened.
Right, but you're not saying that it's connected to what decisions he makes in the interim, right?
I think it might be.
Really? I mean, the Coens draw that distinction because literally the second he makes that C minus, which is such a funny moment,
he
adds that angry minus on the letter.
Yeah. That's true, but you know what? For some reason, I didn't read it that way. It did happen immediately after that.
I mean, I read it that way, but I also don't think the Coen brothers are insistent that that's the truth. I think they're deliberately making it a possibility, but not... I don't think they're giving us any answers in this movie. I think it's left up...
Just like it could be a Dybbuk, could not be a Dybbuk. We don't know. And part of being a human and being on this planet is kind of just having to accept the fact that sometimes we don't know and we're never going to know.
Can I get us sidetracked for half a second?
Yeah.
I was thinking about that, the first scene where he's writing down Schrodinger's cat. I love the physicality of all the actors in this movie. I think it's deliberate and very weird. Like, when you see him writing on that board,
he's crouched down.
Stick it out. And then you look at Simon Helberg's character as the rabbi. He has his shoulders, like, hunched up. And I think most of the characters have this very bizarre, contorted physicality.
I was thinking about that with the guy on the tenure committee who keeps showing up in Larry's door. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of, like, leaning to one side always. It seems a little bit hunched over.
Yeah.
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 Well, his brother's hunched over too.
His brother's hunched over too.
That's right. Well, his neck is all cysty.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what it means, but it seems like it's deliberately a choice on the Coen brothers' part to have everyone bending in directions.
Yeah. Not to mention all the, Coen brothers' movies always have like great old people.
Yeah.
Just like great, kind of like creepy looking old people.
Good on
there's
that.
There's a ton of them in this one.
Good on that kid for not being grossed out when his earphones went in that old dude's ears.
Yeah. I was going to guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, ooh.
Like, God, there's probably ear hair touching those.
Yeah.
Like a ton of ear hair. Okay. Basically, what I think is basically going on at the Larry Gopnik thing and why all these things keep happening to him is I think he kind of does deserve what's happening to him. It's very easy to look on this guy.
But he's not doing anything.
But exactly. He didn't do anything. He hasn't done anything. He says that over and over throughout this film. And you could say, well, he seems like a nice guy. It does seem like he hasn't done anything wrong. But it's the very fact that he's such a passive character.
Can I make a distinction on that, too?
Sure.
People use the word nice all the time when they talk about people like, oh, he's a nice guy. He's a nice guy. Right. But it actually doesn't mean anything because I think nice is an active thing.
Right.
Whereas harmless is a better word to describe most people because they're not doing anything active.
Right.
So like Larry would be harmless, not nice, because he doesn't do anything.
Yeah, if you're nice,
he hasn't done anything.
If you're
nice is an action.
Yeah, if you're nice, you're kind of going out of your way to do something for somebody else.
So I'm just saying, I've made that distinction about people in my life too. I'm like, oh, but he's a nice guy. I'm like, no, he's not. He's a harmless guy. That's different. Like people who used to be my friends and stuff, I realized they were harmless rather than nice.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
cut people out of your life.
Yeah. Shit.
Yeah.
You're just not nice enough for me.
No, but I'm saying you just realize like, you're like, but this person isn't mean. Like they're not bad. They're not malintentioned. Like they're not actively trying to do anything to hurt me. But then you realize, wait, but they don't do anything. Like they're not a friend. Like they don't, friends do something, they're nice, that's like an action. So
okay. Well,
anyway, I'll just
That distinction, I think Larry Gopnik's an extremely harmless character.
Yeah.
Basically seems almost incapable of in fact taking any sort of action at all throughout the movie. You see it a bunch of times, like he almost knocks on Mrs. Samsky's door but doesn't actually do it. She's got to let him in herself. He almost fixes the antenna but doesn't actually manage to do it. I think the scene actually where this all really crystallized to me is the scene where he's out and he's talking to his brother outside by the swimming pool.
Yeah.
And his brother's like, you know, life is shit. You know, Hashem, he hasn't given me shit. Mm. You at the least, you have a family, you have a job. And he's saying, God wants you to fix your problems yourself. And he's giving that advice, but he's refusing to take that advice.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's a clear moment of that.
And then immediately after that, you see him drive his brother out to like the Canadian coast and give him the bribe money and send him on his way.
Psych.
And it seems like finally, for the first time in this film, he's actually taking some sort of bold, decisive action to help somebody who's like really genuinely in need. And then it turns out it's just a dream.
Yeah. I think Michael Stuhlbarg, is that how you pronounce it?
I think Stuhlbarg? I don't know.
Yeah. his performance is so perfect for that, too. Yeah. Because he's almost acting... He's not big at all. Well, he is, but like only in the perfect way for that character. But he's acting almost like a spectator in his own life.
Yeah.
Like, his reactions mm-hmm. are as if he's mugging to a camera that aren't there.
He does constantly kind of look around, like, confused. Like,
what is this? Yeah. Who's doing this to me?
The other line he keeps saying, besides, I haven't done anything, is, what's going on?
Yeah.
He's just constantly in a state of confusion.
Yeah.
So you just have this guy who's basically incapable of dealing with his own problems and seems overwhelmed by them.
So why then does he get his worst news when he finally does do something?
It's a good question. I think of it like that moment where he finally decides to just give in and change the kid's grade is only barely an example of him doing something. In many ways, it's just him taking the easiest possible way out.
That's true.
You know, he's not actually like going to any sort of higher authority to get the kid kicked out.
Yeah.
Or calling the police or doing anything. He's just erasing a letter in a book.
Yeah,
that's fair.
That was in pencil, yeah. Yeah, he was very passive.
It's definitely a dark take and kind of a punishing take, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it is a relentlessly negative movie in a lot of ways.
But it was so funny.
It's really funny.
I think it's really funny, too. Yeah.
That's why it's watchable. Sometimes mm-hmm. I don't like really sad, like, messed up movies, but this one worked for me.
That's how I felt about Burn After Reading, where I was like, this is what Burn After Reading want to do, where it's, like, really heavy stuff throughout, but so many humorous... Like, it didn't... To me, there wasn't enough humor in Burn After Reading, and I wanted it
to I think there were lots of moments that tried to be funny, but the humor didn't quite work.
Right.
Here, maybe because there is... You do a better job setting up the characters, so the characters actually seem more like human beings and a little less like caricatures.
And from the people I've talked to about this movie, it is true that it reads better to Jews for whatever reason.
I was just going to... That was the next thing I was going to say after I was done yawning.
Yeah.
The Jewish parts were so funny. Yeah. It was just, like, all the names. I couldn't even keep up.
And they're not even... I didn't have any of those experiences, really. But there's just something... I don't know. There's something about them that I relate to in a weird way.
For sure.
Yeah.
All those names. Did you talk to the rabbi?
Right.
Like, this guy... Oh, it was great.
Yeah. Not only does, kind of like I mentioned before, this fall into, I think, a tradition of kind of Jewish storytelling and Jewish parables, but yeah, it has all these pitch-perfect little details about actually, like, growing up in a strongly Jewish community.
Yeah.
Which I did go to Jewish school until I was in high school, and I went to synagogue all the time and went to a billion bar mitzvahs.
Mm-hmm.
And... those details are so spot on.
Yeah.
It's so perfect.
Yeah, it was great. I laughed every single time they said, like, a Jewish name. I was like, so good.
Which a couple of them were real. Apparently, a lot of the filming was done on real locations in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. The synagogue was a real place. The mm-hmm. law firm was a real place.
The real law firm, yeah.
And owned by the real Ron Meshbesher.
And they put his real phone number in the movie.
That is so cool.
In case you want to call up Ron Meshbesher and get some criminal help.
But it's expensive, apparently. $3,000 50 years ago is...
Ron is not cheap.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool that they did that.
But yeah, God, and Fagel, and
Fagelman.
And Saul Schlutz, and just, perfect little Jewish names.
And the little Jewish faces.
and the haircuts.
That was great.
I did not get hired for my bar mitzvah. I cannot even imagine what that would be like. They made it seem pretty terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
Just having everyone staring at you.
I didn't get high until I was 23 years old, so.
Right.
I was 10 years removed from my bar mitzvah.
Yeah, no, I didn't get high till college.
Yeah.
But I could definitely empathize. Yeah, you're walking up to that podium and you're seeing all your relatives staring at you, and you're looking at this big arcane text, and you're like, everybody's gonna watch you screw up.
Oh, I love them, like, pointing him to the right spot.
Right.
And I was like,
yeah, with like, perfect sound design.
Yeah, you just have to memorize, or at least I had to memorize it rote, my Torah portion, because there's no vowels in the Torah, and
right.
So you can't really read it. You just have to know what it is.
Because I'd been going to Jewish day school and understood a little bit of Hebrew, it was a little bit easier.
Oh, yeah.
But it was still just a lot of memorization. Mm. And it's weird. It's like you're memorizing, like, the world's weirdest song.
Right.
Like, how you have to understand all these lyrics in a language you don't understand.
Yeah, we were very reformed, so we never learned what anything we were singing in anything ever meant.
Oh, no.
They at least, I mean, we didn't know word by word, but they at least told us, like, in broad terms what the thing we're singing is about.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But yeah, at least I think bar mitzvahs now, compared to bar mitzvahs as they depict them in, I think, 1967 is when this takes place.
Yeah.
There's more English now, And, you know, the bar mitzvah kid gets to make a speech and talk about, like, you know, thank his mom and dad for bringing him to this place. Yeah. And it's a little cheesy.
All the classes in this movie are unbearable. Like, none of them would exist today. The Hebrew class, the physics class, they're all so dense and difficult.
I took Hebrew classes, and I can say the Hebrew was kind of spot on.
Really? Was it just people conjugating verbs for... Like,
I mean, you have to learn to conjugate verbs.
I know, but I took Spanish classes. It wasn't just a teacher speaking only in Spanish and just going down the list. And then,
that was definitely part of it. I definitely remember sitting around having to learn to conjugate verbs. Conjugating verbs is hard in Hebrew, too.
Sure.
Hebrew's not an easy language to learn. I've forgotten almost all of it.
Yeah.
But
I don't know it.
But watching, watching this, a lot of it came back.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it's in you.
It is. It's somewhere locked deep in the recesses of my brain.
The bicycle in your soul. You'll always know how to ride it.
That's right.
Really deep, Jake. It's the bicycle in my soul. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, watching Danny look at the old guy, put the earbuds in, and he says, you just have to turn it on. And he says, Ivrit. Ivrit just means Hebrew in Hebrew. So he's saying, talk in Hebrew.
I thought that's what it meant.
Yeah. But yeah, actually, I feel like I had a slightly different take because I understood some of what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
I have to imagine if you don't know any Hebrew whatsoever and this is all foreign to you, that this almost, it enhances the sense that you're living in an absurd world.
Right.
Where you're hearing all these weird words that don't make any sense.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm the right, I don't know Hebrew, but I do know people who speak Hebrew. So it's somewhere in between.
I don't understand any Hebrew and I still... completely related to it, so I don't know.
Where Judith says, I need to have a get, and Larry says, what? And he says, if I don't have a get, I'm going to become an aguna.
Yeah.
What? Like, what are these words you're saying
to
me?
Nobody knew what a get was.
Yeah, right. The little rabbi.
I know what a get is.
I didn't
now
know what a get was.
Well, now I know what a get is.
You knew before?
I did know before.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why.
Yeah, I had no idea. But I was exactly the same. I was like, a what?
But similar... Very similar to, I don't know if you guys saw the movie Pi.
Yes, but it's been forever. That's a Jewish movie, too. I forgot about that.
It is. And there's a similar kind of way that...
To what Richard Kind is doing.
There's a confluence into what Richard Kind is doing, where you're flipping through the Mentaculus, and you see all these weird mathematical drawings that also include Hebrew letters.
Uh-huh.
Pi also did that, where basically this guy invented some sort of secret formula to manipulate the stock market that also tied back into ancient Aramaic prophecies or something like that.
It was Darren Aronofsky's first movie.
Mm-hmm.
Great movie.
I didn't see it, but I know it.
Yeah. But
it being that. Yeah.
There is something about, that ancient Judaica and seeing Hebrew letters mixed in with stuff that gives it this very arcane and mystical quality.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of, Judaism just, it feels like a very old, old religion. Mm-hmm. It just goes way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something cool about how it's presented here. Like you go into Rabbi Marshak's office. And everything just seems decrepit and old and full of all these weird texts. You're entering another world.
That's, again, IMDb trivia, but that's the scene that the entire movie was written off of. They wanted to do that.
That is true.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
We talked about how in The Man Who Wasn't There, the Coen brothers saw a picture of old 50s haircuts and said, we want to make a movie based on that.
Yeah.
Sometimes they just have a weird germ that becomes the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the germ was... Back when the Coens were growing up in a suburb very similar to this suburb, because they grew up in a heavily Jewish community in outside Minneapolis in the 60s, there was a rabbi who would give the bar mitzvah boy a secret message every time it was his bar mitzvah, and nobody knew what the message was.
Huh.
And they decided, okay, let's make a movie that has that rabbi figure out what the secret message is.
Yeah. Interesting. I like that.
In this case, it's just quoting Jefferson Airplane. Once again, an absurd world where nobody really has the answers.
Right.
He says, here you go, you can have your radio back, be a good boy. Maybe that's the answer. Be a good boy.
But he's a man now. That kind of bothered me.
That's true.
I thought about that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, actually, to be technical.
Yeah. It's true. Be a good man.
Mm-hmm.
I think all the performances throughout this were honestly really incredible. Michael Stuhlbarg was pretty
very
unknown
strong.
Before this. He'd done some theater in New York, but hadn't really acted in movies or TV at all. He auditioned to play the guy
in the prologue.
But then they kept calling him back for stuff and eventually made him the lead. And he does... he's just very expressive.
He's very good in it. Yeah.
And he's very believably pathetic, and you're completely with him as he's just experiencing all these things one after the other.
Yeah.
Richard Kind is pretty solid as his brother too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's an interesting character that sort of goes undealt with in a lot of ways. Like, yeah. He's probably a gay man in the 60s and a Jewish settler. Very taboo, and like,
yeah,
it's never really addressed beyond that one scene.
And he's got a constant get up to drain his cyst.
Yeah, that's very gross.
Oh, God. But you do get the sense that, that all of Larry's problems that keep piling up one on top of the other are kind of, they're like, they're white people problems.
Right.
They're just
I think he has legitimate problems.
Yeah.
He has, like, no money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's...
His wife is leaving.
But it's not just
white people.
No.
But it seems like a temporary thing because his wife kind of comes back by the end.
I don't know
if I agree with that point. Like... I think that when Richard Kind says, like, you've got everything, Yisham didn't give me shit or whatever.
Right.
I think that's more just about relativity and how we all see the shit in our own lives rather than really saying that Stuhlbarg's life is that good.
I don't want to I'm not going to necessarily say it's good. It's obvious the things he's going through are, like, painful things to go through that could, seriously mess up his life. I guess I'm just saying that... any one of those things taken by itself is something you could probably deal with. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just the fact that all these things are converging at once that makes it seem like he's can't deal with and he's very put upon.
But I think like all those things are all really big, serious things. Like, number one, his divorce. That's like very huge and traumatic. And then his concerns with like work and like trying to get tenure. That's like everyone's problem too. Then he has a separate problem with his brother, who of course he needs to help, but he doesn't have the money to help.
Right.
I think individually those are all pretty serious.
But there are,
even if he deals with all of them, at any point a giant tornado could show up, or he could die turning into a country club.
I guess that's what I thought of the ending. Is like, you think all these problems are serious, but as soon as you get a diagnosis about like your health and realize you might have a death sentence, suddenly all those problems seem like they're not as serious
anymore.
Right.
And the parallel of that was his son finally giving the $20, but it doesn't even matter anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. The kid had the same issues. Whereas like, you think this problem is a big deal, but you're 13. You don't even realize how tiny your problems are.
Yeah. That last shot, I think, is so beautiful and interesting.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Completely gorgeous.
Yeah.
Just an incredibly crafted movie to get to that point.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
I liked how you said, unlike something like No Country for Old Men, we don't necessarily like see the terrible consequences in the aftermath. We just build up to that moment and then cut off, and it's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the ending.
It's a really, really well-crafted movie throughout.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think in many ways, kind of them at the top of their craft as directors and formalists. A lot of interesting editing choices, a lot of cross-cutting between different plots and different things going on.
Yeah.
Oftentimes you'll see Larry like trying to deal with one problem. Like, he's looking at the notes of all the things he got at work, people leaving him messages. And then as we're looking at that, we're hearing another person come in and start a whole new problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which really effectively creates the sense of overwhelm.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is just like nonstop, one problem after the other. He can't even deal with one before another one starts.
Yeah.
But okay. So going back to like, overall theme and stuff too, I've been thinking about this whole time since you said your point of view also. So I guess there is some punishment to being so passive in your life.
Yeah.
And just because he did say it so many times, like, I didn't do anything.
Right. Have you published anything? No, I haven't done anything.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I guess that is like a message. So I guess I wonder if the Coen brothers are trying to make that point of like, you can't just be so unaware and not make any decisions, but then I still see so much randomness to it too. So maybe it's a little bit of both.
I think in many ways the message is just supposed to be random, terrible events will happen to you, and you have to like the quote at the very beginning of the movie, receive with simplicity everything that happens to you.
Hmm. Yeah.
Just things happen, accept it,
deal with it,
somehow. Deal with it. You get stabbed in the chest, laugh. You laugh in the face of terrible things.
Hmm.
I think in many ways that's the Coen's strongest message, and one that you can apply back to a lot of their movies, even like the dude in The Big Lebowski, who's another very passive character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot more likable because he deals with the strikes and gutters of his life always with total simplicity and just kind of taking it and letting it wash over his back, and it's very zen.
Yeah.
And it's kind of implied maybe this is kind of the way to be in the world.
I found the protagonist in this movie strangely relatable, though. Like, he would be a really pitiful character in the hands of most directors. But I don't know. I kind of liked him.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
They, I mean, it's very easy to relate to a character like that. Because we're definitely completely in his point of view. And it's very easy to step into those shoes and feel like, I understand what it's like to have all these problems and feel that kind of stress
and overwhelm. And you could spend your life trying to find the answers, or you could just live in spite of them.
Yeah.
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 But it so often seems like, hey, maybe the answers to his problems are just right in front of his face. And maybe there are simple steps he could take, like helping Arthur across the border that might solve his problems, but he never takes a step really in any direction. He just keeps asking for help from
everybody. And he could have turned that envelope in day one.
Yes. Like, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird that he
You know, you don't know what caused the problems in this marriage. It's left deliberately unanswered.
Because they didn't do anything.
But you gotta figure.
You have to assume, yeah.
Yeah, it's just because this is just a guy who doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
Judith.
Sai does lots of things.
Sai does lots of things. He is a serious man.
Sai Abelman? Sai Abelman.
Yeah, and Judith says, you know, it keeps saying it's not about Sai. And you believe her. You believe she's not necessarily really into Sai. She just needs to get away from Larry and sees this guy as like a way to do that.
Yeah, although I think she is kind of charmed by Sai.
It's weird. It's hard to imagine being seduced by that guy.
Right.
God, just he really does make your skin crawl. It's such a perfect
I definitely know people like that, too. Like, yeah. It's an accurate characterization of a certain type of Jewish person.
Yeah.
That's true, yeah. 100%.
I saw one person in a review describe him as Francis Ford Coppola on Quaaludes.
Ha!
which I love. He does kind of look like that.
He looks like Coppola, yeah.
I really do think you just keep going through this film and you just keep seeing more and more indictments of that kind of passivity and seeing like moments like there. If things are going bad, if your wife, maybe there's Mrs. Samsky sure seeps into you. Maybe just go with her. Or I don't know.
Oh, I guess, but you could. Sorry, go ahead.
Nah, I wasn't. They never even, besides a dream sequence, they never do anything but smoke weed explicitly in the movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They fail to do anything.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't have a chance because then the cops came.
The cops came, right. Yeah.
So,
total boner killer. Yeah.
I'm just saying, maybe he would have done something for once in his life. Although I love how pathetic his dream sequence was, too. It was so funny. It was
just like unhappy.
Yeah, but then it's like he dreamt that, so it was even worse. Right. Like, you would think in his dream it'd be so like perfect and sexy and like
even his dreams, he is on his back not doing anything.
Yep. That's true.
In every single situation.
Yeah, so weird.
Or like, what about like, his one female friend who he talks to for one scene in the movie.
Yeah, who was she?
She never comes back.
No, yeah.
But that's a big question to be like, he seems really like open with her and willing to share himself and comfortable with her in a way he doesn't seem like with anybody else in the movie.
Yeah.
Who is this woman?
Yeah.
That is interesting.
Maybe, I mean, so okay, at one point he's asked like, do you want to get back with Judith? Do you want to have things back to the way they were? And he says, yeah, well, no, I mean, maybe, I don't know. He doesn't know if he wants to really be with his wife. Maybe the divorce is a good thing. Maybe he should go with this girl who seems totally into him.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. Unless it's his sister.
Unless it's his sister. I don't know. Maybe it's his sister.
Damn it.
I'd be curious to see like an original draft of the script to see if that's legit, like a character that was written down or legitimately a choice to make it a one scene character.
Right. Or maybe they had more moments of her that got cut out.
Right. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say. A lot of these things, it's left deliberately mysterious.
Yeah.
A lot mysterious about this film.
Yeah. But he, I think he also, in addition, I mean, he obviously could have made other choices with like other women, like, okay, it's not working, I can just be with somebody else. At the same time, because he's so passive, I'm sure there's so much that he did that made his wife, who was not a great character, she's obviously like mean and bitchy and like pushy and just like,
but
not
maybe,
a nice
but
person.
Maybe she got pushed to that point. Yeah, maybe she's trapped in a loveless marriage now. And
maybe, but I bet there's so much he could have done before to like pay attention to his wife so that like she felt loved and connected to him that he never did because he didn't do anything. And then, you know, he's past the point of that working probably, but there's stuff he could have done even with her in addition to also making choices to be with other women. So he's very, he's so stuck.
Right.
<guy.
laughs> You know, the one thing he wants more than anything is to get tenure.
Yeah.
Which is basically just an excuse to not do anything for the rest of your
life. That's true. That's what tenure
is. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Finally, maybe I can make that happen and then all my dreams will come true. Yeah.
That's true too. Yay. But he does make tenure.
Well, he doesn't officially.
He's about to, but then he's going to die.
He won't be dead by tomorrow, though.
That's true.
It's he'll a have Coen a Brothers movie, so you never know.
You never
know. There's a tornado, right?
There's the tornado.
Right. Yeah, maybe his son will die. You have no idea. It's left pretty vague. It's just clear bad things are about to happen.
Right.
Yeah. Although, by the way, the fact that the tornado got so close makes no sense.
Why?
I mean, I would think that they would have warning of the tornado much sooner than that. Or is it that
sudden? Have you lived in tornado country?
No.
I know they have tornado alarms, but I don't think they necessarily go off until a few minutes beforehand.
Yeah, really? Also 40 years ago.
It's not like a hurricane like... where you have days in advance.
Right.
No, I know. Okay, I guess that's true. I guess maybe I'm thinking more about hurricanes, but I was just like, what do you mean? It's like suddenly there.
No, there's like YouTube videos of people now driving through tornadoes because they're idiots.
Yeah, that's true.
Storm chasers.
Yeah. Not even storm chasers. Just like, hey, look at that.
Tornado level 5, the finger of God. I still remember that movie.
Well. Twister? Is that
Twister? Fuck yeah.
It's been a while.
Classic.
Then they made the other tornado movie this year that no one went to.
They did?
Yeah, what was that called?
Tornado movie.
I don't even remember what it was called. It came and went pretty quickly, but they made
like a tornado.
Hey-o.
Jinx!
You beat me.
We're on the same page. Uh-huh. Again. Jackie, you've become really picky about movie music in the last few episodes.
Yeah.
What did you think about the music in this movie?
It kind of grated me, but I accepted it.
Why did it grate you?
It's probably supposed to, but in all those shots of like all the suburbia, the pinging sounds, I don't remember exactly the music, but I was just like, oh, this is such annoying music. It sounded like a...
They had one motif they used over and over again.
The
plinky harp thing.
Yeah, the harp thing was really annoying. I was going to say harpsichord, but yeah, harp or whatever it was. I was just like, what is this? But I think that was intentional.
Yeah.
And it wasn't too much like, fucking what's it called? And Burn After Reading, that was so annoying to me because they were trying to do a specific style that was way too much, didn't work, ugly sounding. And in this, that plinking was ugly sounding, but there wasn't too much of it, so it didn't bother me. Like, I accept this.
It was used mostly pretty subtly, and it does have that kind of slightly off-kilter touch that
I think it's supposed to have.
Which I think was appropriate.
Yeah.
I thought the score was fine. I did love the use of classic rock in this movie, though, which I thought
was really effective. Oh my god! Wait, yeah, duh, I love
that. I was watching it at 2 a.m. last night, though, so I didn't appreciate how loud it became. It's
right.
Yeah.
Right.
That was
it's
great.
A very quiet movie that has
for most
sudden
of it, and then suddenly there's rock energy.
Oh my god! Yeah, that was actually
and
so
in,
great.
And you know, in many ways, it's a reminder that this movie does take place in 1967.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right as you know, there's kind of not just the music revolution, but there's signs of the sexual revolution happening, and it's definitely that kind of turning point. Mrs. Samsky being kind of a perfect embodiment of the new freedoms.
Yeah.
Perfectly played.
Come in.
Yeah. She's like, I can't put my finger on exactly what makes her so good, and she hasn't really limited about screen time, but she's so perfect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She was funny. I love how she was bossing around. It was the best.
Yep.
Why don't you drink this? Come on. Whatever it was that she said.
You'll find you need the iced tea.
Yeah.
Somebody to love. You know, it's deep. When the truth is found to be lies and all the hope around you dies. Mm-hmm. Don't you want somebody to love?
That was stuck in my head for so long afterwards.
And I think there are like 5 other Jefferson Airplane songs that show up. There's a lot of Jefferson Airplane.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite, though, is the Jimi Hendrix during the Goy's Teeth.
Oh yeah,
scene.
Right. Yeah, it was great.
The combination of that and all the Dutch angles that they're using, the tilted angles.
Yeah, it's only in that sequence.
Yeah,
there's only I noticed that too.
Which makes it seem like this very weird psychedelic interlude all of a sudden.
Yeah, but there is an inaccuracy I wanted to point out too.
Sure.
I am pretty sure that in the imprint on his teeth, like the mold that he took,
it was
engraved the Hebrew letters.
And but it would have popped out.
But on his actual teeth, it was also engraved.
Yeah. I was wondering the same thing.
That's not going to work.
Shit. Well, this isn't a perfect movie.
It's not. And when sometimes they fail in their attention to detail. It would have to be...
No, it would be engraved in the mold.
Would it be engraved in the mold?
Yeah. Because it's divoted in on the teeth, so it would be divoted in on the mold.
Oh, okay.
No, you're right. Because it does make it right. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
You are right.
Okay. Yeah, good.
You almost threw me off.
I know, because I was thinking about it. I didn't think it through completely.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah, because it would be the same as your teeth. Yes. Thank you. Good.
We were going to write an angry letter.
Yep.
I would have. I'd be like, good movie, but the teeth thing, it just doesn't add up.
Coen Brothers, 2 things. 1, come on my podcast. 2, this fucking Goy's teeth situation.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Okay, good.
I did go to a Jewish school, but it seems really different than what it would be like to live in like this completely Jewish community. Mm-hmm. Where whenever there are the couple of times like non-Jews show up, and they are referred to as goys, which is kind of not an especially nice term.
No.
Yeah.
They're just totally regarded as interlopers. And I mean his neighbor, the goy neighbor, is a totally scary guy.
Oh yeah.
But this other guy doesn't seem nice.
You like?
I've never lived in a Jewish community.
Neither have I. And I always in some ways wish that I had gone to a public school, because like I would have liked to have known kids growing up who weren't Jewish.
Well,
to
yeah,
feel like I, actually,
but you feel you field a lot of real dumb questions if you go to a public school and you're Jewish. Let me tell you, mostly about the little hats. And,
where'd you go to school?
Burbank High School.
Okay, yeah. Where'd you go for like elementary and middle school?
I was in Burbank by the time, so Jefferson Elementary and John Muir Middle School.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I went to Walter Reed in the, like. For middle school, so
okay.
But yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is, there's so many Jewish kids, especially in the Valley, that
not in Burbank. I was like one of two or three in every class.
What?
You
no way.
Aren't all the studios
there? We didn't take any of the holidays off.
What? Oh my God, that's so crazy. When I was in middle school and I went to public middle school, I had so many Jewish friends, and like I remember it was a shock to me when I found out that Jews are 2% of the population.
Oh yeah.
I was like, I'm sorry, what? Because I have a bar mitzvah every single weekend, sometimes two in a weekend. I had no concept.
Yeah, my life was not Jewish. Like that.
That's so weird. Yeah, I thought everyone was Jewish when I was a kid. I was like, all right, everyone's Jewish. Like, I didn't know.
Yeah, right.
But I thought I just thought because I was a kid, I thought my life experience was like...
Right.
The world.
The world. Yeah, right. It's like just a smaller like microcosm of the world.
It started to happen to me more recently. I've met a couple people recently who are like from the South and are like, I've never met a Jew before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a totally, I was asked legitimately, so you guys don't believe in Jesus? Like so that's like Jewish rule number one.
Yeah.
The first thing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely not. But the thing is, I think I'm in a weird spot because you didn't have that many Jews in your school.
No.
So you already knew, and then you went to Jewish school where you were probably taught about how Jews are such a small population and we're so special and we're so like...
Oh yeah, we're the chosen people.
Yeah. Right. But I'm not talking about that, but I'm saying like there's so few of us or whatever. Like you knew that growing up. I didn't know that growing up. So then when I was in school, I just assumed this is what the world is. So it was like a very weird, like tons of Jews around me, but not that specific like Jewish cultural education of like, we are a small part of the world, and we got to like keep it going. We got to marry Jewish. Like I didn't have any.
You're right. You just figure the world is like West LA when it's not.
It was the Valley, okay?
or the Valley, whatever.
And then I went to Catholic all girls high school for a year, so that was really interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I was like one of two, or maybe one. I think I might have been the only Jewish girl. It's a very different experience.
So I mean, in Catholic high school, there you got to have some like legitimate like Christian teachings.
Just had a theology class. And then,
it was a mandatory theology class?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
It was, like, kind of historical. I don't really remember what I learned, because so long ago, but it wasn't bad. I was like, all right, I can accept this.
It's just, like, reading about, okay.
Yeah, and because also when I was a kid, I went to Russian school. On Saturdays, I went to Russian day school, and it's connected to the Eastern Orthodox Church. So, like, I definitely had a lot of, like, Christian stuff when I was a kid, too, that I was just like, whatever.
I think the study of religion is very interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, we got into comparative religion a little bit in our school, and it is really fascinating.
Although, my Russian school, just to be clear, like, they were such haters. Like, they hated Jews. They hated Catholics. Yeah. Like, I remember, because,
it's Russian, right? So
it's Eastern Orthodox, but like they would always like even shit on like Catholics for like the way Catholics cross themselves versus the way we cross ourselves. I was like,
wow.
It was beyond, it was like a little primitive, which I guess is disappointing. Like it wasn't like respectful of like there's other types of people and this is the way we believe in it. It was just like, we're the best, everyone else sucks, Jews suck, Catholics suck, everyone sucks. It's like, okay, I don't know.
Yeah.
It was weird.
Oh yeah, one little detail that I was curious about, that one of the few details that rings a little bit false to me, is that the kids barely seem to notice their dad is gone. They seem really kind of uncaring about
concerned about
their parents' divorce
or
really anything that's going on in their family whatsoever. They're just totally in their own little world.
But don't you think teenagers can be really self-absorbed and like they would display that way even if they are torn.
Right. Maybe they're torn up about it. They just don't want to actually tell anybody that's what they're feeling.
Yeah.
I guess that's one way to read it. I guess
my parents are still together, so I don't even know.
Well, oh, lucky you.
Good for you, man.
I saw them on Thanksgiving just 2 days ago.
Oh, what a happy family.
I saw them on Thanksgiving too, but they're divorced, so it was awkward.
I saw my mom's family. Okay.
mm. And one little, I know you're always a stickler for anachronisms. Mm. So one very interesting anachronism, when he's on the phone with the Columbia Record Club.
Those mm-hmm. records were not from...
Yeah. Yeah. Both Santana Abraxas and the next selection of the Columbia Record Club, Cosmos Factory, were both from 1970.
But did you also...
I hate this movie.
Attached to that was the fact that Abraxas means, like, God, or...
Does it?
Yeah, that's why they use that title, presumably, because Abraxas is a religion, religious... It's a... Ah, man, I read it last night. I had no idea.
I love you looking stuff up.
Yeah, me too. Thank you for doing the work, man.
Yeah.
Most people
well,
don't
I
fucking
do that.
Bother.
That's not... wasn't for the podcast. Anytime I watch a movie, I go read the IMDb credit trivia afterwards. Yeah.
I had assumed that similar to the way lots of, like, Hebrew phrases are kind of thrown around to make the world seem more absurd, I think just him saying Santana Abraxas is just such a silly...
funny.
Such a silly phrase.
It was, but then
it's... just like...
But that means Satan and religion or something, right?
Santana means...
Well,
Satan?
Santana's just his
Santana's
name.
Santana's the guy.
Carlos Santana.
No, but like, doesn't Santana... doesn't... I'm sorry, I could be wrong.
All right, go ahead.
That'd be very weird if he was named Satan.
Or like, I thought
Carl
it was like
Satan. Carlos Santana. Yeah.
But it has... it sounds like that.
But yeah, it's just another example of him being... It's kind of the movie in microcosm, actually.
Sure.
It's him being confronted with this absurd situation and him just saying, I don't know what this is. I haven't done anything.
Right.
Over and over again. But that, yeah, that was a very funny scene too. This really is a funny scene.
And that would actually never confirm that it was his son who did it. In fact, the sisters thinks it wasn't. Like,
right.
No, you're only using the money on weed. Like,
yeah, you don't know what he's really using the money for.
Yeah,
or I mean, for all we know, maybe he just got signed up to the Columbia Record Club by a vengeful god as one more problem to throw in his face.
I'm literally so wrong. I'm the opposite of correct. It's like
saint.
Informal
means
for
saint.
Santa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course it does.
Okay, whatever.
Right. Well,
I've been wrong about two things today that I don't like. This has never happened before. The teeth and then Santana. Mm. I'm just embarrassed.
You should just stop.
Cut out
right
all
now.
Those parts.
Okay. Okay, sure. I'm not going to.
I know, that's fine. I accept the mystery that I'm wrong sometimes.
Hey,
And hey, by the way, yeah, that is where the title of this podcast came from.
Yeah.
I'm glad we can finally...
That was so exciting.
Yeah.
The phrase "accept the mystery" was said by Mike Yanagita himself.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Park, who also showed up in Fargo.
Oh. That was him? I didn't even recognize.
Yeah, same actor.
No kidding.
Yeah. One of my favorite moments of the movie, because it's another Schrodinger's box moment of is it defamation or are you accepting money?
Right.
You know what? Who knows?
I think
accepting mystery.
It's also not defamation.
As much as it's a good storytelling thing, I also think it's a joke, because the whole bit is that he does not understand Schrodinger's cat.
Yeah.
Like the Korean cat. Yeah. You're failing because you don't get how it works, and yet you've created it.
Well, you know, Larry says, too, the math is what's real. Even I don't understand the difference.
Right.
Which is kind of ironic.
Yeah.
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 But pointedly says, you know, these stories, the cat is just the stories we tell ourselves to help make sense of the world.
Right.
Just like this movie is kind of a... And the fable at the very beginning, it's a story that we might use to kind of help make sense. It's layers and layers and layers. That's when I'm like, hey, man, it's like a mentaculous. You can just keep going. I've seen this movie 5 times. Every time I find a new layer to unlock.
Mm.
Part of why this is, one of my favorite Coen movies, actually.
Me too.
It might actually be a dark horse for the top spot.
Ooh.
There's just because it's both their most philosophical movie and their most personal movie, just all those little touches feel so lifted and so real. And because of that, you really feel invested in this character and on board with him for this this journey he's taking, trying to understand the world he's in.
Hmm.
And which makes the ending that much more unsettling.
Yeah.
Even as much as the ending of No Country for Old Men was unsettling, this movie even more is an ending that really stayed with me. And it's like, wow, this is a dark world we live in.
Yeah. No, I just I'm a little bit torn about the accept the mystery versus, you know, being inactive in your life, and mm-hmm. that you really should be active in your life.
Yeah.
And like, and I guess I'm sort of struggling because it's so, for me, it's so personal, because I'm such a like, do it, keep doing it, keep moving, keep pushing, keep struggling, keep working, keep breathing, keep like what everything.
Do you
like,
have a good work ethic? I do not.
But in a different, like, it's not like you would like see me at work and be like, whoa, she's like this star, like, so I'm a lawyer.
People
like
think I have a very good work ethic. It's a weird
you
thing.
might have a variation of a work ethic that is just not the classic, like, working a million hours in a row, but your work ethic works for you.
I think my work ethic is getting better. I used to be that's a lot lazier, and I'm getting better at it. But it's still, it's
I would be writing a lot more, I think, if I actually had a good work ethic.
It's very easy for me to slip into, man, I'm not doing nearly as much as I could be.
My PlayStation 4 arrived right as I left for this podcast. You better believe all I'm doing the rest of today is
you're like,
plugging
it's okay
in.
If yeah. you're late, Jackie. No problem.
No, literally, I was opening my door to leave, and it was there. I'm like, all right. Okay, gotta do this podcast.
Oh, great. That's
and then you will reward yourself
that's
with
right,
the game.
That's right.
That's what I do with myself all the time. It's like, okay, I'll push myself through a little work, and then I'll reward myself with, I don't know, Cheetos.
Yeah. Oh, I love Cheetos. Don't talk about Cheetos.
All right, sorry.
They make me sick now. No, but, okay, so going back to like work ethic and just like, yeah, like working through accepting, I do have a good work ethic, but it's weird. And I also feel confused all the time. So it's hard to say whether I have a good work ethic. I don't know, separate issue, but in general, I do like work really hard in life. Like I'm always like very like,
you're a hustler.
Yeah. I would say I'm a hustler.
That's great.
And
it's a good thing to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good. But I think sometimes it's also like you're beating your head against a wall sometimes. And like, I think there's just an important balance between like hustling and also accepting the mystery. Yeah. So it's so weird. It's getting so thematic to my life. I can't even deal with it. It's like, oh.
Well, it's a good,
like
it's
my
a
life,
life
movie.
Lesson.
Yeah.
It is. But,
like I'm an actor. Like you have to do both. You can't be totally passive or you'll never do anything. And you can't try to solve why you didn't get this part or you will drive yourself insane.
Yeah. Cause that's the thing. It's like you're hustling and like you get so many roadblocks and so many obstacles. And like, just me personally, I've been with so many roadblocks with just like my work life and just like my professional life in general. So then you get very like the hustler side of you just gets like really frustrated, I guess. But then it's like the balance that is accepting the mystery.
I don't think those two things are contradictory.
No, I don't think they are either.
I think it's like you keep doing and you keep trying things. And then a lot of times those things are just going to backfire or not work out.
I think
it's
100% balance.
So you laugh and you do more and you just keep doing more.
I think trying to figure out why something happened in the past is not being active. And
that's
so
that's true. But even why something in the present does not seem to be working, like, and I'll say that like relates even like to my personal life. Like if I feel like your relationship like doesn't work out, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, but like why? Like it makes like no good real sense as to why. And then at the time you're just kind of like, I don't know, I just accept it. Like that part has nothing to do with your hustler side. Like there's just nothing you can do and all you can do is accept. So I think hustling always needs to have that accept the mystery part. But sometimes you just accept the mystery, you don't hustle, there's nothing you can do. And so these themes are very like real and applicable to my life right now.
I guess I think of it like you never like, I mean, if you're a hustler, and I'm definitely not a paragon of this because I'm not nearly as much of a hustler as I could be. But at least the ideal is
you've got a very good soundboard. That's
Like a baller soundboard. Yeah. At least
that's something. Yeah. It's a soundboard that a hustler would own.
That is true.
but you just keep trying and you keep pushing forward and. Yeah, and sometimes it will completely not work, and you just you can't get frustrated with it. You can't stop trying to do things. You just try something new. You just keep finding ways to take action and better yourself. And when it doesn't work, you laugh about it, and you say, such is life.
Yeah.
I guess. Mm. I don't know. That's how I try to reconcile it.
Maybe that is kind of like the theme of this movie, too, where there is so much of like, you just need to accept things. But you also need to do things.
And in a way, that's what it means to be a serious man. A serious man, like, deals with his problems. He doesn't just keep saying, why me? Why is this happening to me?
Right.
Oh, maybe.
That's a very Jewish thing.
It's a very Jewish thing.
Why me is a Jewish sentiment.
Oh, yeah.
I think
was literally why me-ing last night. I was like, why? And I was like, okay.
I mean, I think the Jewish work ethic is very strong. And I also think the Jewish guilt over not working hard enough is very strong.
But that's what I'm talking about is a problem, though, actually. Because that's what makes you neurotic.
It's rooted in history. Too.
Yeah.
It is. Oh,
yeah.
And it's kind of like, okay, it's like you're just always like suffering almost because you're working yourself too hard in certain ways, even if it's just like in your head. Sometimes like you suffer from like either hustling, you know, whatever, hustling is a very general term, but like from just like working too hard, you get like, I don't know, you feel like you're like hitting a wall and then you suffer because of it and then you don't accept the mystery and then it creates neuroses.
Yeah.
So it's like the Jewish condition. And I kind of see that, like, just looking at my family, my grandparents, like, especially, you know, I'm first generation, so I've seen so much of this, like, very specific, like, just keep working, but, like, you're also supposed to enjoy life.
Sure.
Right.
And you're also supposed to just, like, accept the things that, you know, there's that serenity prayer. I don't know if it's a Christian thing. I assume it is, but it's like something about like
the power to accept the things I can change.
Right. And then to know the difference.
Yeah. Right.
Like, and it's,
we got that totally wrong, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And accept the things I can't. And
the, like, wisdom, God, yeah, the wisdom to know the serenity difference. Like accept the things, you know, but it's such a,
is that actually a religious thing? I sort of thought that was just like a charming quote that Christians,
the wisdom to accept the change I can and the serenity to change the difference.
No. I want none of us to know what it is.
No, but now I want to know.
Look, we're good Christians.
Yes.
I want the power to change the world, the serenity to...
I'm looking up serenity prayer right now.
That's not where my neuroses come from.
Where do your neuroses come from,
Jake? Too much empathy. I'm the opposite of a sociopath. I'm always considering how my actions affect others.
I'm very strongly empathetic for that same reason. I never want to like inflict myself on other people.
Yeah, exactly. But people want to be inflicted.
Also, a very Jewish thing too.
Yeah.
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
There we go.
Sorry, that applies to this movie. Think about it; it really does.
Accepting the things I cannot change. Receive
courage to change the things I can, instead of saying I didn't do anything.
Yeah, it is. It really is.
That's very interesting.
Well, before we get to our final segment, are there any final thoughts or just overall thoughts about this movie?
I feel like I have more of them, but I can't even express them.
Yeah. My thought is, you guys are you're both getting so many texts and calls right now. You're both so popular.
Very annoying.
I'm not.
This is my mom calling me, okay? Uh-huh. I just called
myself
that.
So popular.
My text messages are from other people.
Jackie's incredibly popular. Yeah, I'm not. Yeah. I'm just reading the same email that has all my notes on it.
got it.
What if he was just like texting the whole time?
Sorry. I'm only half here, guys. I'm in the virtual space.
Sure.
Okay, well, in that case, yeah. All I'll say is, yeah, absolutely one of my favorites. If you haven't, watch this movie.
It is very good.
Watch it again, and there's just a lot of layers and a lot to unravel.
I was nervous about it because, for some reason, I sort of expected something more on the burn after reading type of vibe. But then you said it was one of your favorites, but then I know sometimes, like, you and I have very opposite views of what we like.
We do.
So I was a little scared.
Often types of movies I think are very funny. You're not quite on the same wave.
Yeah, that's an example of that.
Raising Arizona.
Raising Arizona would be an example.
I didn't hate it, but I just, it didn't like really speak to me that much. Although I loved Nick Cage's performance, but
those movies are full comedies. This is not a full comedy.
Right. So I didn't know if A Serious Man, like how much of a comedy it was or wasn't. So I was nervous because I kind of got the vibe that it was like a little bit of burn after reading, but maybe a comedy, which weirdly it sort of was.
I would consider this a full comedy, but I have weird opinions about things.
Interesting.
I consider a lot of things comedies.
I was laughing the whole time. So I
think you have to go out of your way to make a story not a comedy. I think most movies and television shows are comedic in nature because they're about...
No Country for Old Men?
No, that's not.
Okay.
Right.
And although it does have comedic moments. And like, The Hunger Games is not a comedic movie. But so many movies, any movie that's just about the unusual happening to the usual... Like, it's all about denial of expectations. It's all about the weird foibles of life and characters and everything's funny. I don't know. This is comedy theory to me now. But
I mean, if you really want to go comedy theory, I was thinking, okay, like the Aristotelian comedy is that everything, you know, everything unravels and there's hijinks, but then it all wraps up back together by the end.
Right.
And the main character is linked in a better, possibly in a better space than he was before.
That may not
that
be
doesn't,
true.
That doesn't happen here.
That's true.
So in that case, it's almost a tragedy.
I guess it is.
It's a very funny tragedy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I saw it, as a funny tragedy. But that's like life. You got to laugh at everything.
Life is a funny tragedy.
But like,
because it always ends with death.
That is true.
I consider The Sopranos a comedy. I find it to be very funny.
It is very funny.
Yeah.
Josh has not seen The Sopranos.
I have not seen The Sopranos. I can't comment on that.
I love The Sopranos.
I like The Sopranos. I will not say I love
The Sopranos.
I think there's a lot to like about it. I think it's a little uneven at times. But it's very, very
watchable. I think that happens with the TV show.
Yeah.
Right. It's hard to expect perfection from any TV show.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyways, the final segment that we have for today is a segment called Raising Arizona. It It's a quiz with a theme loosely inspired by the movie. Mm. And today, the theme is Jewish mythology.
Yay! Ooh,
I'm not going to do well. Yeah.
Neither will I, but I'm so happy.
Basically,
the answer is the golem for all of them. That's what I got.
Actually, your first question is about the golem, so we can hop right in.
Hell yeah.
All these are multiple choice questions. You're going to have one of three possible answers to choose from, and and Jack will be facing off.
By the way, it's kind of lucky that both Jake and I are like not super educated on this subject, right. Uh-huh. Because that was just like dicey on your part, because we're Jewish. Like, one of us could really know about Jewish mythology. Yeah. So
it's true. But Jewish mythology...
You almost created an unfair quiz.
I know nothing about Jewish
mythology. I might know something in the deep recesses
maybe.
Of my brain,
even
so we'll see.
But even for Jews, a lot of this stuff is pretty arcane. Because
yeah.
This is
like
even,
a get, like, which actually he did know about, but yeah.
But this
yeah.
isn't even biblical stuff. For the most part, this is going to be drawing from like Jewish folklore and mysticism.
Right,
I might know
right.
some then. Yeah. We'll see.
I'm intuitive, so I could figure it out.
Oh, maybe. Me too. Whoa,
yeah.
It's on.
Yeah.
All right, so here's our first question. One of the most famous monsters in Jewish mythology is the golem. It's a giant clay being that can be brought to life. The most famous golem was built to protect the ghettos of 16th century Prague by Rabbi Judah Lowe. He wrote Emet on a golem's forehead to bring it to life. Emet means truth. But he forgot that golems come with rules you have to follow, kind of like gremlins. So what rule did Rabbi Lowe forget when he built this golem? A. Don't leave a golem alive on the Sabbath. B. Don't get a golem wet. C. Don't let a golem indoors.
Ooh. I'm going to go with, you know, even though it seems like a deliberately fake answer you wrote to try to throw me off, I'm still going to say A.
Don't leave a golem alive on the Sabbath?
Yeah.
All right.
That's the one I wanted to say, because I don't think it's B, because that's like
B is a Gremlins reference.
Gremlins reference, which would be weird if it was true, because Gremlins is based on Gollum. That'd be really funny.
Yeah.
I think it's A or C. I'm just going to go with A also.
Congratulations, you guys are both right.
We know something.
There it is.
Sabbath.
When the golem was left alive on the Sabbath, he went on a murderous rampage. but he eventually managed to stop the golem by smearing its forehead and turned the word Emet to Met, which means death.
Wow.
Pretty deep stuff. Second question is the golem
legend. Was vampires, by the way.
Yeah. You can't let a vampire inside.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I withheld that information, hoping you would pick me.
You're a smart player, and I respect that.
I don't respect that.
The golem legend has been a major influence in pop culture. In addition to being a direct inspiration for Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, it was a major influence on a play by the Czech playwright Karel Kapek. Oof. He wrote a play in 1921 called R.U.R. It later became most famous for coining which word? A. Puppet. B. Robot. C. Monster.
I know the answer to this, so I'm making you answer first.
Oh, man. All right. Let me try to read both through minds at the same time.
Karel Kapek's 1921 play R.U.R. was famous for coining the word puppet, robot, or monster.
R.U.R.?
Mm-hmm.
I know this from my theater training.
Unfair quiz.
It's my only question related to theater.
Yeah.
There better be a law question on here. I'm just going to say robot.
That's it. It's robot.
You guys are both right again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't even take a theater class. How about them apples?
RUR stands for Rossum's Universal Robots.
Yep.
And although the robots in the story they're like biological creatures, they're like assembled in a factory.
Right.
And robotics used that term.
Yeah, because other words seem too old, but yeah.
I have no idea when those words were coined. They're probably old words. Question number three is about Lilith. Lilith is a woman who, according to some legends, was Adam's first wife before Eve.
Ooh, wow. Scandalous.
So before Eve was created from Adam's rib, Lilith was created from the same clay as Adam. Unfortunately, as soon as she was created, they immediately began fighting. Lilith saying she would not lie below Adam. She would be his equal or even his superior.
Dang, Lilith's cool.
Yeah. They named the Lilith fair after her for a reason. She was like a feminist icon. Adam wouldn't listen to her, so she ran away. And then Adam complained to God and asked God to bring her back. So what did God say when Adam complained to God? A. Let her go. She will become an angel, and I will make you a more suitable wife. B. I will make you taller and stronger so you can go catch her. C. If she does not come back, 100 of her children will die every day.
D. Accept the mystery.
Ooh. Can you read those again?
Sure. A. And you can't look at your phone.
I'm not. I'm trying to fucking put it on, like, do not disturb. Stop buzzing. I'm being disturbed.
Let her go. She will become an angel, and I will make you a more suitable wife. I will make you taller and stronger so you can catch her. If she does not come back, 100 of her children will die every day.
I'm going to go with that crazy answer and say C. I'm doing it.
I'm going with A.
All right, Jake gets it.
Oh, boom! Fuck. Boom!
Lilith eventually actually became a demon because God never let her, she never came back. God allowed her to live on the condition that 100 of her demon children will die every day.
Mm.
Yep.
What a bummer.
God.
Yeah, I know. The Bible is pretty patriarchal.
Yeah.
They're not into women standing up for themselves.
I was trying to think, like, well, maybe there's, like, a nice message in this. And then I should have known, because then I was like, because probably it's not a nice message.
Well, A still isn't a very nice message.
No.
I'll make her an angel?
No. Your wife wants power? I'll make you a more suitable wife.
Yeah. Somebody who's subservient to me. Yeah.
No, but I mean, like, as far as, like, who's going to die.
Or right, sure.
All right.
Suffering involved. Yeah.
Question number four. Agrat Bat Balat is a Jewish demon who is an angel of sacred prostitution, which is a euphemism for what's commonly known as what sort of creature? A, a harpy. B, a succubus. C, a genie. Agrat Bat Malat, the angel of sacred prostitution.
Is more commonly known as?
As a harpy, a succubus, or a genie.
I have a strong thought, but I'm going to make you answer first.
No, I will not answer first.
You're just going to copy me, though.
I don't think so. I think I have my own strong answer.
No, she usually goes her own way.
All right.
Yeah.
There's definitely...
So insulting.
There are two answers I'm torn between a little bit, but I know more explicitly that a succubus is a spirit of having sex with people, so I'm going to go with succubus.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
You guys are smart.
Yeah.
Boom.
All right. Once she managed to seduce King David and bore a son, Asmodeus, who became the king of demons. So that's pretty sweet.
Hmm.
Yeah. There's a couple succubi in Jewish mythology, actually.
Yeah.
Question number five is about Adibic. As possibly spotted as a serious man, Adibic is the malicious, dislocated soul of a dead person. Which of these is not a way to invite the Dibic into your home? A, having a sloppily made mezuzah on your door. B, doubting that Moses really crossed the Red Sea. C, not washing your hands after prayer.
B, yep. all about Moses.
So two of those ways will invite the Dibic into your home, one will not.
Yeah.
I think it's B.
Yeah. B.
Yeah.
You guys are both wrong.
Ooh! Yeah.
Wait, hold on, let me guess again. Just for shits and giggles.
Okay.
C?
C is, yeah.
Yeah.
If you have a shitty mezuzah, or if you ever doubt that Moses really crossed the Red Sea.
That's such a weird specific thing.
I know.
I don't even have a mezuzah on my door.
I don't either.
Well, I think that's better than having a shitty mezuzah.
Maybe.
I think you can't get in trouble for that.
Interesting. Good, then we're saved.
We're fine.
Number six, numbers have a ton of importance in Jewish mythology.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
For instance, the Talmud claims that in every generation, 36 people meet the Shekhinah, or divine presence, and they are known as the 36ers in Jewish myth. What else is true about the 36ers, according to Jewish mythology? A. They will all disappear at the exact instant the Messiah appears. B. If one of them dies, the world will instantly come to an end. C. Their souls guard the 36 chambers you must pass through to reach Olam Haba, the world to come.
Wu-Tang!
Can you reread the question?
The Talmud claims that in every generation, 36 special people meet the Shekhinah, or divine presence, and they are known as the 36ers. Either they will all disappear at the same instant the Messiah appears, if one of them dies, the world will instantly come to an end, or their souls guard the 36 chambers you must pass through to reach Olam Haba.
In every generation, there's 36 people.
Every generation, there's 36 people.
I'm going to go with the Wu-Tang answer and say the 36 chambers.
That's what I was going to say.
You guys both fell for my trap answer. There are no 36 chambers in Jewish mythology. But if any of the 36 people die, the world will instantly collapse.
Really?
That doesn't
really.
Make
that would have
sense.
Been my third choice because that does not make any sense.
But it says 36 in every generation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's their soul. So I don't. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Well, they have to die. The world can't end just because
someone
dies.
Oh, no. I mean, they will. I mean, if they're like murdered, I think the world will come to an end.
But that's different,
that's not
Josh.
What the answer was,
you know,
Josh.
What? This question is stricken. It doesn't count.
It has been stricken.
Murdered is totally different.
Yes.
Well, you guys both.
Everyone's going to die.
If you guys want to strike it, you can strike it.
It's been struck.
It's been struck. All
right.
Struck.
Fine.
It was so ordered.
So you guys know, the number 36 is also the number of hours Adam and Eve spent in the Garden of Eden.
Oh.
Which I did not know. I thought it was way longer.
Apparently
it was just a nice day and a half.
They got bored quick.
Yeah.
Really.
What's that apple?
Yeah. Sorry, that apple just looks really good.
Yeah, they're tempted so immediately. Yeah, I'll eat an
apple.
Might as well. Question number 7. Most strains of Judaism do not believe in reincarnation, but if you are a Kabbalist or a Jewish mystic, they have the concept
Madonna.
Of...
Madonna. The answer is Madonna.
The answer is Madonna, yes. Apparently she believes in Gilgul, or the cycling of souls. According to Kabbalah, every time a soul is reincarnated, it is considered A, superior to the previous incarnation, B, inferior to the previous incarnation, C, an evil reflection of the previous incarnation.
Every time the soul is reincarnated.
Every time a soul is reincarnated.
Superior. Going superior.
Yeah, it has to be superior.
The answer is inferior.
Hmm. That's a bummer.
Every
you
time
get worse and worse.
Yeah, every time a soul is reincarnated, it's a little bit worse than the soul before it.
Why?
Basically, we're farther from God's word, and so we're less able to understand God's word than people who were alive closer to when he was.
Is that explaining why people have become less and less religious, maybe?
I think it might be part of that explanation.
Yeah.
But they also...
Oh, that's crap. I don't like it.
I know. It's kind of a shitty
Let's
answer.
Strike it. Let's strike it.
We don't like the Kabbalistic tradition, no.
They also do say that if certain saintly souls or tzaddikim do get smarter and smarter, but they're only a very small percentage of the population.
We were doing so well at the beginning of this quiz, and then something went very wrong.
I know. You were nailing it, and now you guys are getting it wrong.
Mm.
Well, Jake is up by 1 point with 3 questions left.
Ooh.
So, Jackie, you can do this.
I don't want to ruin this.
Question
Saturday.
8. Uh-huh. What is the Tigris in Jewish mythology? A, an enormous lion. B, a dragon made of water. C, an angel with a tiger's head.
Ugh. I do not know the answer to this. This is like that straight up mythology type
stuff,
right?
Oh, yeah. This is straight up mythology.
Know.
I'm just going to say A.
What was A?
An enormous lion.
An enormous lion.
Wait, I thought I said enormous tiger.
No, I said enormous lion.
Okay, sorry. Read the whole question again.
What is the Tigris in Jewish mythology?
An enormous lion.
An enormous lion.
A dragon made of water.
A dragon made of water. An angel with a tiger's head.
Man.
A.
I'm going to go with B.
We got a tie game.
Dang! Giant lion.
Because, yeah, the Tigris is an enormous lion. In fact, so enormous that here's question 9.
Can I explain why I said dragon made of water?
Sure.
First of all, that's an insane answer. I thought it would be funny. B, because the Tigris is also the river next
to
Euphrates.
That's how I came up with that. It's like, hey, maybe somebody would think it's like a river monster.
Yeah.
The Roman Emperor Hadrian once asked Rabbi Joshua ben Hananian to show him the Tigris so he could prove that all lions can be killed, even the Tigris. Joshua warned Hadrian that this was no ordinary lion, but he reluctantly called for it. In response, the lion roared one time. And when he roared, what happened? A. Every bird in Rome fell from the sky and Hadrian's palace crumbled. B. Every Roman child went deaf and Hadrian's skull cracked in half. C. Every pregnant woman in Rome miscarried and the city walls crumbled.
Oh my god. Is there no all of the above?
There's no all of the above. Only one of those answers happened.
Oh, man, that's a tough one.
Can you read the answers again? They're all so heavy.
Every bird in Rome fell from the sky and Hadrian's palace crumbled. Every Roman child went deaf and Hadrian's skull cracked in half. Every pregnant woman in Rome miscarried and the city walls crumbled.
I'm going with miscarriage.
Jake says miscarriage, Jackie.
I'm going with A.
Jake's up by a point again.
Boom!
Fuck my life. All right.
That felt very biblical to me.
It is kind of a biblical answer, yeah. Right? Yeah. The lion, by the way, after that came closer and roared again. And that time, the front teeth of every Roman fell out. And then Hadrian just like begged Josh would have sent it back. Yeah. So,
what if these things actually happened? How crazy would that be?
That would be, right?
That would be, yeah.
Just like a city full of people with no front teeth.
And big old lion.
Yeah, but a bunch of miscarried babies.
Yeah.
God. One question left, so Jackie can at least tie.
Plan for a tie. Unless I deliberately answer whatever you answer.
Unless it's a tiebreaker.
I will not vote for what you vote for just out of spite. I will
genuinely try to
answer this question.
Great. So this is a question about the Re'em, which is an enormous beast, considered big even among monsters, with a single horn on its head so big, King David once mistook it for a mountain and tried to climb it.
What an idiot.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it still looks like a horn, right? It's still like a horn-shaped thing. Noah had to strap them to the side of the ark so they could survive because they wouldn't fit on the ark.
Mm. Huh. Wait. All right.
Yeah, I know.
I know. Look, you just got to stop questioning it at a certain point.
Accept the mystery.
Accept the mystery.
There can only be two on Earth at any one time or else the Earth would crumble, and they live on opposite ends of the Earth. They don't see each other except for once every 70 years they meet. And when they meet, what happens? A. They mate, then the female kills the male with a single bite. B. They mate, and then the female bears a child that slaughters both of its parents. C. They burrow into the ground, pull a giant egg from the bowels of the earth, and die.
Every 70 years?
Every 70 years.
I mean, here's what's going to happen.
Right.
I'm going to pick wrong, but only because two of these answers do not make any sense.
What do you mean you're going to pick wrong?
I'm going to be wrong, because... I'm going to explain my logic to you.
Okay.
You just said there's only two of them at any given time.
Yeah.
Both options B and C explicitly say only one offspring is being created.
Well, no, that's not necessarily true. In the third one, there's only a giant egg that is being pulled from the earth.
Oh, and it's an egg. Yeah. What do these guys look like?
But eggs have one, unless they're actually twins.
They're a little bit like bulls with a single horn.
They're bulls with a horn?
Kind of like a bull unicorn.
Bulls are mammals. They shouldn't have eggs. Guys, I have a lot of issues with this question. man.
Hey, look, they fit on the side of the ark. David thought it was a mountain. It's the deal. It's the deal with these guys.
Yeah. Man.
What is it called again?
The Re'em. R-E'em.
So basically the way they would survive, say it was like number, or was letter A, then it would just be like, the female kills the male? Is that what you said?
Female kills the male with one bite.
And so they have one child.
So when the baby...
None of it makes any sense.
I didn't say it has one child. Only in B does it have one child.
What's A again?
They mate, then the female kills the male with one bite.
Hmm. But there's only two at any given time.
It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. I'm preemptively striking this question.
I like that. I'm preemptively striking.
It all makes sense once I read the answer out.
Yeah. I'll go A.
Yeah.
You're both saying A?
Yeah.
All right, well, see, here's how it works. They mate. The female kills the male with one bite. Then the female becomes pregnant for 12 years, has twins, and dies in childbirth. So then the twins wander in opposite directions and the cycle continues.
Boom.
A lot of incest.
Right? It's like the Targaryens. They're just mating and mating.
We don't watch Game of Thrones.
How do you even know that was a Game of Thrones reference?
Because a lot of people have spoiled things for me.
All right. Fair enough.
We don't watch Game of Thrones.
Well, I don't watch The Sopranos, okay?
All right.
We weren't talking about it ad nauseum like some people.
I mentioned it twice. That's pretty good for me.
Ad nauseum. She's a lawyer, for God's sake.
Guys, we got to wrap things up.
Real quick, who won that game?
Jake won the game.
Oh! I don't remember that. This is a good guess, because he fucking gets it. Most people are like, so what's the point of the quiz? I'm like, you just win.
I'm intensely competitive about all
this.
Me
too.
Yeah.
I feel like the only other person who is as competitive is probably Joe Hartzler.
Hartzler?
Who didn't show up, but I know Joe's competitive. But like everybody else is always like, what? So do you win something? I'm like, it's your pride, baby. Like that's all that's at stake. And nobody else understands why it's so important. So
pride's
you know
important thing.
You're a good, like...
Thank you.
Adversary. Yeah,
and knowing that you have superior knowledge about Jewish mythology.
That was a fluke. It was one thing. I bet there's other stuff that I would know more about.
I hope that
too.
Plus the PS4 carries you through your day.
let's do law quiz next time, and I'll still beat her.
Oh, well, that's a challenge. That is a challenge.
Okay. All right. We can have you back. I'm down.
Yeah. Except there's no more Brothers movies.
Oh, there's more.
There's a couple more.
There's some in the works.
Yeah. Plus, we have a couple non-canon ones to get to, too. There's a movie coming out soon written by the Coen brothers, directed by Angelina Jolie.
I saw that. That's crazy.
So we're going to cover that one for sure. But yeah, by the way, what did you think of the lawyer in this movie, Adam Arkin? I thought he did a good job.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think his dad is one of the more talented people.
Alan Arkin is great, yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought he was one of the guys who was like on Larry's side and actually was like kind of empathizing with him. It was nice.
Also a bad Jew. Didn't know anything. I was like, what?
No.
What?
Again? Oh, well, not really illegal.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Jake, thank you so much for coming on
the show. Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
thank you.
This was great to talk about one of my favorite Coen Brothers movies. It was fantastic.
So
if you want, is there anything you'd like the good people of the internet to check out?
Follow at Jake Regal on Twitter. If you're in the LA area, Cardinal Redbird performs at the UCB Theater, both Franklin and Sunset. Just look for us on the schedule.
You both.
Yeah, we're at one or the other every week. It's a little hard to figure out. So just look at the schedules. Yeah, that's it. JakeRegal.com, I guess, but I don't know how to update it.
Sweet.
Cool.
Yeah, I have yet to. I've seen you guys at Franklin. I have yet to see you guys at Sunset.
Go to Sunset. It's an insane theater. Like, it's crazy.
We've been to Sunset, but haven't seen Harold.
But I haven't seen Harold Teams at Sunset yet.
Yeah.
It's a cool theater.
It is a cool theater. Man, it's big and it's really sweet.
Yeah.
We saw Joe Hartzler's show there.
We did see
it. Oh, I was there too. Did you get a picture with the jumping?
Yes.
Yeah.
We did.
Well, we must all have those. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jackie, you actually made a really good tweet.
What?
I forgot.
Believe it or not,
are you kidding me?
You actually made a good tweet.
No, I was like, I was going to bring this up because we usually read your best tweet of the week.
I'm the worst tweeter ever. I can't do it. I can't get behind it. My humor does not come from 140 characters. My humor comes from my mannerisms. So.
Sure.
But a couple days ago, you said, my abs are sore from coughing. Who says lawyers are too busy to get in a good workout? # exercise, # life hacks. It's like, that's a solid tweet.
Thank you. I didn't even know. Thanks.
So go follow at MacLean on Twitter.
MacLean.
I said MacLean.
You kind of said MacLean.
I said like MacLean because I was correcting myself as I was saying it.
It's not MacLean, right?
It's not MacLean.
Mac tonight.
And you can follow me at Radio TFB and go to joshmitchman.net and accepthemystery.net to check out all the back episodes.
Woo!
It's hard to believe we're towards the end of this.
I know.
But we still have a couple great movies to watch and the Fargo the TV show and a wrap-up episode.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a couple months yet.
Woohoo! But,
yeah.
Good. Woo! Something to live for.
For sure. And I think next week, I'm not sure. Either we're going to do Two Grit or we're going to do a weird off-canon episode.
Cool.
One of the two. It's going to be fun.
Awesome.
Anyhow, guys, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for being here. It has been a real pleasure.
Jake.
Until next time, peace and love.
Peace and love.